Good Wednesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad you joined us today. Once again, coming to you from beautiful Farmville, Virginia, site of the 2016 vice presidential debate. It did kind of strike me today that the circus is going to be coming to town at some point. Our quiet little community here is going to be the center, at least for a day or two, of the circus later in the year. I'm not sure we're ready for that. Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition will join us on the program later on in the hour. We talked yesterday about Governor Terry Branstad signing the Hearing Protection Act into law after really broad bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate. That is not unusual for suppressor legislation around the country. What is unusual is that it's not unusual to see those broad margins, given how polarized politically we seem to be in virtually every aspect of legislative activity. So we're going to talk with Kurt about the process of getting this bill into law. We're also going to talk about what the bill actually does with Kurt Liske later on in the hour. Next hour, Antonia Okafor, our friend with the Students for Concealed Carry, and today is her NRA birthday. I'm excited about this. She got her NRA membership in the mail today. We'll talk about some more Texas colleges. We've been focused primarily on the University of Texas at Austin in terms of the campus carry debate, but don't forget, I mean, this is throughout the state of Texas, and there are a lot of university systems in the state of Texas beyond the UT system. So a number of these schools have been coming out with their recommendations. They're not even their recommendations, their policies for campus carry. Some good, some bad, some really ugly, according to Antonia, but we'll break it down next hour. Also, Seton Motley of Less Government, who says that intellectual property protection is a fundamental free market tenet, not a tax. Okay. He's piqued my curiosity, which is something, given that the phrase intellectual property protection is one of those phrases like campaign finance reform that tends to make people's eyes glaze over a little bit. Katie Moyer, political writer. We talked with Katie up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the Great American Outdoor Show. She wrote a piece about campus carry as a recent college graduate and a gun owner. So wanted to get a millennial's reaction to this Cosmo video. Watch four women tell their boyfriends how they really feel about their guns. Because I realize, in many ways, I am not the target audience for that Cosmo video. I understand. I accept that. Katie, on the other hand, is kind of the target audience for that Cosmo video, except for the fact that she's a gun owner. So I thought we'd talk with Katie about it in hour three. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media will join us on the program as well in hour three, talking about some of the news and issues of the day. And since we're going to be talking with Antonia Okafor about campus carry, and that has been such a big issue, not just in the state of Texas. We told you about protests at the Capitol in Kansas late last week. Flagpole Magazine in Athens, Georgia, with a story yesterday, opposition to campus carry bill at UGA grows. 66 parents who attend preschool on the University of Georgia campus say that they adamantly oppose House Bill 859. They say, as parents, we constantly weigh the safety risk of an activity as balanced against the development it can provide for our children. We do all we can to minimize unnecessary risk, sometimes choosing not to allow our children to participate if a safety risk is too great. We require our children to wear helmets when they ride a bicycle because we want them to be as safe as possible while still having the opportunity to grow and play. House Bill 859, the campus carry bill, presents an unnecessary risk to our children. Governor Deal, we appeal to you, they write, as a parent and grandparent, and ask you these questions. Would you want people carrying guns where your grandchildren go to school? Would you want people with guns walking by your grandchildren's playground? Would you want people with guns riding the bus with your grandchildren? Would you want people with guns coming to your grandchildren's classroom? You know, again, they live in the state of Georgia, where concealed carry has been the law for years. I'm pretty sure that these parents, if they ever set foot off a college campus, I'm pretty sure that they're interacting with concealed carry holders in general society. And again, there haven't been any issues. So why would there be an issue if a concealed carry holder is allowed to carry on a college campus? They're the same individual that they are when they're off campus. And they're not an issue off campus. Again, this appears to me to be an anti-carry argument. Do you want to be around people who might be carrying a gun? Well, again, you've had the concealed carry law in Georgia. There's been no unserious attempt to try to repeal the concealed carry law. In the meantime, more and more Georgians and more Americans have become concealed carry holders. The latest statistics I saw, a couple of years, maybe this was like last year, 13 million Americans. It's probably going to be higher than that. Texas has gone across 1 million this year. They're at 966,000 right now. Florida has 1.2 million, I think, at last report. And a number of other states show record high numbers of concealed carry holders. If your argument boils down to, I don't like concealed carry, well, I hate to tell you, but I think that argument's largely been settled. Not by the courts, but by the American people. Again, we have 42 states that are shall issue concealed carry. We still have the Peruta case out of the Ninth Circuit that is still, they still have not issued their oral argument in the en banc review, which happened months ago. They're still sitting on that that decision. But you remember the original decision in Peruta made very clear, you have a right to carry a firearm. In fact, even the Heller decision made pretty clear we're talking about a right to keep and bear arms. The question in Heller dealt with keeping arms inside of the home for self-defense. So they didn't really get into the bearing of arms in public, but they made it pretty clear that, just like the keep part was for real, so is the bear part. And again, we the people, even if you want to make that argument, the founding fathers, they couldn't have known what was coming. Okay. But the American people in state after state for decades now have passed laws supporting the right to bear arms. So it's not just that this is some dusty right that was consigned to history and then all of a sudden we wiped it off and, aha, look here. No, this is something that, again, Americans from coast to coast have been putting into practice for decades. So as an argument, we can have that discussion. But I don't think Americans are particularly interested in getting rid of their right to carry. So then again, we have to get into the discussion of why would these individuals who are concealed carry holders, who have their Georgia weapons license, who are behaving responsibly in their daily activity when they're not on the college campus, why would they behave differently when they were on a college campus? These parents say, furthermore, we believe that a robust and open academic environment requires that all feel safe and free from intimidation and or potential violence. If House Bill 859 is enacted and students and faculty are hesitant to discuss sensitive or controversial topics because of the presence of guns on campus and in our classrooms, the academic integrity of UGA will be greatly compromised. Well, again, as that professor put it in the Chronicle of Higher Education, in 25 years, no student has taken a swing at me. I don't see why campus carry would change anything. If these discussions, these sensitive or controversial topics were leading to you know, increased emotions and you know, wouldn't we see this in fist fights in the classroom? Now, I'm not downplaying the fact that we do apparently have some emotions running high on some campuses. I saw some student, you see this, Cameron? Some student got yelled at for having dreadlocks and culturally appropriating dreadlocks. I think that was at San Francisco State.
Not just yelled at, but physically attacked. And when he tried to de-escalate,
yes,
he was pulled back multiple times. It's I think Twitchy just, I'll put it at Cam and Company. People should see that video. It's kind of disturbing when you're seeing, you know, all the, you know, people can't take what happened with chalk on college campuses. And now we're talking about a physical assault at one. It's a video people should see and react to because it's very disturbing.
It is. And, you know, look, everybody's offended about something these days, without a doubt, right? However, you also have to look at the totality of the college experience. Is everybody on a college campus a precious snowflake? No. Are the precious snowflakes prone to flipping out and attacking professors or other students? More interested perhaps in calling for muscle, complaining to the administration about microaggressions, trying to get a new college established and you know, new policies in place. But no, we have not, again, seen the instances of students flipping out and attacking other students over controversial subjects in class. We just haven't seen it. And again, the stories that we don't see every day, because they're not precious snowflakes that are streaking for attention, we don't see those college students, those faculty members, the administrators who are, you know, generally speaking, grown men and women. They're not doing anything newsworthy. Why would we hear about them? But again, they're the vast majority of people who exist on a college campus. Whether or not they're concealed carry holders, that's the vast bulk of the population of the campus body. Now, the concealed carry holders, those, again, who are students, faculty members, administrators, those who are currently carrying concealed off campus, you know, again, those folks aren't newsworthy either. As a matter of fact, if they're concealed carry holders, this won't be an issue in any class. Because it's not a matter of intimidation. It's a matter of self-defense. It's a matter of following the law and carrying that firearm concealed. To me, the arguments against campus carry ultimately boil down to the argument against carrying a firearm. And we've been having this debate in state after state, year after year. And I got to tell you, the anti-gun activists, they keep losing this debate. In the legislature, at the ballot box, and hopefully soon in the highest court of the land. But again, a lot of that depends on what we do this election year. All right, we're going to take a time out here in a minute or two, talking again with Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition. You know, meanwhile, talking more about what's going on campus, I saw at Emory University, home of the pain-inducing chalkings, the president there of Emory University has engaged in some chalking of his own. James Wagner expressed his support of free speech in chalk. We told you yesterday about the Young Americans for Liberty group at Emory putting up chalkings of every candidate in support of a free speech. There was a separate, quote, nonpartisan coalition of Emory alumni began parallel initiatives asking Emory to overhaul the university's restrictive speech codes and officially commit to protecting free expression on campus. James Wagner visited a Young Americans for Liberty campus event last Friday, talked to the students, and even added his own sidewalk chalk message to the array of student chalkings, reading, quote, Emory stands for free expression. And this is from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Well, let's hope so. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education quoted a couple of students and alumni. One said, my Emory experience, which I look upon fondly, was periodically defined by eruptions of illiberal behavior from various student groups, although nothing as shrill and totalitarian as what we are witnessing today. He also said administrators used to err on the side of free speech. Nowadays, they seem inclined to appease the worst intolerant and alarmist instincts of some students while undercutting the foundations of free speech, tolerance, and a robust debate which should thrive at a university. See, this is where I don't understand the argument, too, by the opponents of concealed carry, that you know, this robust debate is taking place. We're also hearing that it's not. And it has nothing to do with campus carry. It has everything to do with a deliberate attempt to actively chill the freedom of expression. I mean, that's happening apparently right now. And oddly enough, I don't see many of those parents talking about that. I see them talking about what they think could happen or would happen with the implementation of campus carry, even though what they think could happen and would happen has not happened. It hasn't. In those states that have actually adopted campus carry, none of what they are predicting to come true has come true. And yet here we have this very real threat to chill discussion of controversial topics that could stir passions. And what are these parents saying? Nothing. Does kind of make me wonder if that's their real objection. Doesn't it make you kind of wonder if it's their real objection? All right, when we come back, Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition will join us on the program. Stick around. We have much more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information headed your way right here on NRA News, Cam and Company.
What is your barbecue of choice in Austin?
It is Terry Black's Barbecue in Austin. Nice. Love that place. Under siege by local authorities because apparently the smell of barbecue smoke is offensive in Austin, Texas. So,
yes, go check it out. It hipsters. That doesn't matter.
No, that's just it. It shouldn't irritate hipsters. I mean, that's the whole essence of being in Austin, Texas. But I was just giving Cam tips on good rib barbecue.
Mustard. Put the mustard. I've got a microphone. Yeah. Thank you.
It puts the mustard on the barbecue or else it gets the hose.
Or else it gets the rub again, I believe is right.
All right, so I'm going to go back to my special across the street, across the lot.
Why are you leaving? Do we run you off there? All right,
no. I just, we have limited microphones and you know, something.
I'm really glad I got invited. It's great.
Why are you still here?
It's really good. That's fantastic.
Tony's used to a little more one-on-one time, time here.
No, what we need is more Andrew Langer. That's the said no one ever, including his wife.
God, it gets worse.
Good Lord.
Wow.
This is happening.
Oh, there you go.
I heard there was a party over here, and I wanted to just see what was happening. I'm trying to tape a special across the hall here, and it's getting very noisy, and I wish you would all. And who's the one with the British accent that keeps interrupting
that's
everybody?
Tony.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. It's Tony Katz.
I've lost complete and all control.
You've had about 3 minutes to think of a question, and you still haven't managed it.
Here's the thing. Who's the question to right now at this point?
Ask all of us. We'll all answer.
Okay.
What's the question?
Ask the question.
Ask the question.
What is the question?
Here's a ratio, people. A ratio.
Here's my question for you. Obviously, you haven't had anything like this chaos on the show, on your show.
On my show?
Yeah, over the
last
couple
of years.
It feels
good, Larry O'Connor, like it did in the old days. This is how Larry worked his way through everything.
The young Americans who raised their hands to fight radical Islamic terror deserve a commander-in-chief as courageous as they are. They volunteered to fight an enemy you won't name, and many gave their limbs and lives to win ground you surrendered. No previous generation of American soldiers, sailors, airmen, guardsmen, or Marines have been sent into harm's way by political leaders so unwilling to define what matters most, victory. These brave patriots have a deeper understanding of America's place and purpose in the world than Washington's so-called elites and their media enablers. And someday soon, in places America liberated, then abandoned, like Fallujah, Ramadi, and Mosul. Tomorrow's troops may have to fill their brothers' bloody boots. These are my heroes, willing to fight and die for my freedom. And I demand a commander-in-chief worthy of such sacrifice. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
We don't rise up to the occasion, but instead fall back on our level of training.
Champions spend hours practicing for the smallest improvements.
In order not to be a victim, it's important that you have a plan.
That's the perfect time to take your shot.
I am Gabby Franco, and I'll see you next time in another episode of Tips and Tactics, sponsored by Cabela's Outdoor Fun.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, Antonia Okafer, Seton Motley coming up next hour. Right now, I want to welcome from the Iowa Firearms Coalition, our friend Kurt Liske. Kurt, how you doing, sir?
Cam, I'm doing well. Very excited to be on chatting with you today.
Well, I'm glad to have you back on the program, and it was exciting to break the news yesterday afternoon. Governor Terry Branstad signing the Hearing Protection Act. Congratulations. This is big news for Iowans.
Yeah, it is. This is something we've been working for and pushing for. This is year three now. So, you know, nothing seems to happen as quickly as you like in politics. But we finally got one in the win column. And within realistically the next 24 hours or so, Iowa will become the 42nd state in the country to allow private citizens to own suppressors.
That's fantastic. And I got to tell you, you look at the vote in the legislature this year, you would have no idea that it took 3 years here, because you had a broad bipartisan consensus in both the House and the Senate, passed by wide margins, and then the bill signed by the governor. I mean, on paper, it looks like this was smooth sailing. But talk about what went into I know, right? It all makes it sound so easy. But what actually went into these 3 years? How much education did you have to provide to these lawmakers? And frankly, you know, what got some of these lawmakers who may have been inclined to say, oh, no, you know, why would we want to legalize these James Bond silencers, to recognize that the issue really was about hearing and being a good neighbor and, reducing just a simple noise reduction for those mm-hmm. who are using firearms?
Yeah, so... that's a big question. I guess to start, as far as, you know, what needed to be done to change that perception was, you know, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. The hitman, assassin, pick your Hollywood stereotype, you know, that is using a suppressor, you know, that perception was very prevalent here in the state of Iowa. We worked really, really hard, even within the Second Amendment community, to change that perception. And, you know, it was just a matter of just grassroots networking, talking with folks. We put on, demo days. One of the things that we did was have closed events for legislators so they could come literally get a hands-on experience, the same firearm with and without a suppressor. Down in the weeds, like I said, grassroots networking and getting people to get active. You know, once firearm owners get a chance to shoot suppressed, it's something that's hard to walk back in their mind. And, once we got a good portion of our community, so to speak, on board, you know, then they come out and they start becoming advocates. And then they're talking to their friends, and it just continues to snowball. As far as, you know, hey, this does look on paper that it was, you know, smooth sailing, like you said, but, you know, there's a big difference between reality and life on paper. The first year this introduced, it was kind of an unheard of thing here in Iowa. You know, at the time there was, I think there was like 38 or 39 states that had them legalized, but it was just a non-issue basically here in the state of Iowa. And quite frankly, we had the votes to pass this, and this applies to just about everything that we work on here in Iowa with Second Amendment issues. But there was a couple legislators, again, in key positions that basically determine when bills get voted on and if they get voted on, that are and continue to be vehemently opposed to, basically all things that are pro-Second Amendment. They were just, an immovable roadblock for a long time. Last year, the Senate Democrats kind of reshuffled their committee chairman, and that paved the way for us to get a few things through as far as our key judiciary committee where all of our bills get directed to. And that opened the door for the Hearing Protection Act. And we've had a couple of other items get through that committee and with mixed success. But, the Hearing Protection Act, legalizing suppressors, is now on the governor's desk and scheduled to be signed tomorrow. So it's been a long road, but like we said, nothing happens quickly. But we're not going to slow down at all.
So. Absolutely. So let's talk some particulars, Kurt. What does the bill actually do? It allows for the private ownership, as you said, of suppressors. How can they be used at the range? Can they be used for hunting at all? What does the law say?
Yeah, so that was one of the things that we were adamant about, is that it's not just legalizing suppressors, but we want to make sure that they're allowed for hunting, because there are a handful of states where you can own a suppressor, but you can't use it to hunt. A lot of guys want to use these. Coyote hunting and varmint hunting is a big thing out here. We're a very rural state. Coyote hunting and coyotes are a problem, and a lot of guys, spend a fair amount of time coyote hunting. So there's a lot of interest within that segment of our community, and that was a big deal, making sure that they're cleared for hunting. So the Iowa Department of Natural Resources has not, raised any issues about that, and the way the bill is written, we're all clear for that. In essence, what this does is changes the Iowa State legal code, where prior to this, suppressors were listed as what's known as an offensive weapon in Iowa State code, and basically it removes suppressors from the list of offensive weapons in code, and thereby allows Iowans to go through the process that residents of 41 other states already can, in that, you purchase a suppressor, go through the background check, you pay your $200 tax stamp, all that good stuff at the federal level through the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And so basically it allows us to own them, but we still have to jump through all the hoops at a federal level, which, of course, we also support, removing suppressors from the NFA list at the federal level. But it's kind of one step at a time for us here.
Absolutely. Listen, congratulations again, Kurt. I think this is fantastic news for Iowans and really gun owners around the country. So I hope that, as you say, we've already have a majority of states, a wide majority of states that have taken this step. But hopefully now, as you say, we'll see some action at the federal level as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. I know there's literally thousands of people here in Iowa that would love to see that just go away as far as the NFA listing, and that would streamline their purchasing in a great manner. So,
absolutely. Well, another reason to get involved in this election year, right?
Bingo. Yep. Like I said, we're not slowing down. I mean, it's not one of these situations where we get a win and we're content with it. We're going to be pushing our guys, all through this election season and right into the 2017 legislative session. So.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Very good. Thanks so much, Cam.
You bet. Thank you, Kurt. Kurt Liske joining us of the Iowa Firearms Coalition here on NRA News, Cam and Company. And, again, majority of states, vast majority, over 40 now, have suppressor laws on the books. But as those few remaining states take those steps forward, we will certainly be there to bring you the latest news and information. Now, coming up on the program next hour, Antonia Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry. We've talked about the campus carry policy at the University of Texas at Austin, but UT Tyler, Texas State University, Texas Tech, University of North Texas, and a lot of other state schools there in the Lone Star State are coming up with their own policies, and they do not mirror those of the University of Texas at Austin. Each of these universities coming up with their own rules and guidelines. Some of them, students for concealed carry are okay with. Broadly speaking, some of them, they're not really okay with those items. But we'll talk about it with Antonia coming up next hour. Hillary Clinton, in Milwaukee yesterday at a, campaign event at the Tabernacle Community Baptist Church, a forum about gun violence prevention. She said, the epidemic of gun violence spares no one, but it is concentrated in areas that are short on hope and where we still face the effects of systemic racism. She called for universal background checks, called for changes to the background check system so that if you do not come back as denied or approved, it can just sort of sit there in indefinite limbo. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel talked to a member of this congregation, Barbara Ford. She's been a member since 1959. And she said, every day there is something riddling this neighborhood in the form of crime, ridiculous shootings, death. And I would love for her to address how we could turn this gun law around. Ford, the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Journal Sentinel reported, said she specifically did not support Wisconsin's concealed carry law, which she described as a policy out of the Wild Wild West. You know, I think it goes without saying that I would be shocked if any of the violent crimes committed in Ms. Ford's neighborhood were committed by concealed carry holders. That would be a real surprise. But this is where Barbara Ford thinks, you know, maybe changes need to be made. Even though the people who are committing these violent crimes are already illegally possessing and illegally carrying these firearms. In many cases, they're prohibited by law from possessing a firearm or a single round of ammunition. We already have a number of gun laws on the books right now. I wonder, and I don't mean this to be critical of Barbara Ford, and I hope it doesn't come across that way, but do you remember that case we talked about on the program probably a few months ago? I think it was last year, August of last year, in Milwaukee. Dontre Mills. Do you think Barbara Ford has heard of Dontre Mills? I bet she hasn't. I bet the name does not ring a bell. Dontre Mills is 24 years old. He purchased a total of 27 guns between December 12th and April 2014. He used a fake ID to buy them and then sold them on the streets of Milwaukee. He got probation for that crime, those crimes, because he was charged in federal court with 55 counts of buying firearms with fake ID and dealing them without a license. 1 year of probation. That was his punishment. Again, this is already a crime. And the actions of Dontre Mills enabled criminals in Milwaukee to illegally acquire firearms. You know, we are told by anti-gun activists we have to crack down on the bad apple dealers or these unlicensed dealers Okay, well, that's exactly what Dontre Mills was accused of doing, being an unlicensed dealer. Using a fake ID to acquire the firearms that he then illegally sold. And what did the system do? When given the opportunity to act, it did nothing. And by the way, what was the response to this from anti-gun activists? Again, nothing. Did Hillary Clinton mention Dontre Mills when she was there in Milwaukee? No, she did not. Did she mention the NRA? Oh, yes, she did. The problem for Hillary Clinton lies with legal gun owners. The problem with Hillary Clinton lies with legal commerce, lies with our human right of self-defense and our constitutional right to keep and bear arms. But the problem for Hillary Clinton never lies with the people who actually commit these violent crimes, nor does the problem ever lie with someone like Dontre Mills, who supply these individuals illegally with their firearms. It always goes back to the legal gun owners in this country. Have you noticed that? I mean, good gravy. Hillary Clinton's there in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She could have brought up Dontre Mills. She could have said, and I realize she doesn't want to criticize the administration, but she could have said something like, you know, this case of Dontre Mills, I mean, this is one of those cases where, look, I know our prosecutors are working as hard as they can, but we have to prioritize cases like this. And when I'm the president, we're going to make sure that a guy like Dontre Mills doesn't just walk away with a year of probation. My Justice Department won't sign off an agreement like that. Didn't say a word about Dontre Mills. At the time, and remember, prosecutors agreed with that sentence of 1 year of probation. The judge in this case, U.S. District Judge Rudolph Randa, said he recognized the seriousness of the offense, and he acknowledged the problem of guns winding up in the hands of people who use them to commit violence. But he said Dontre Mills didn't come across as a typical defendant because of his good behavior since the charges and his life ambitions, which include becoming a rap musician. While on bail, the judge said, Dontre Mills traveled twice to Los Angeles to work on a film and to pursue his musical aspirations. Do you think, because normally as a condition of your bond, you're not allowed to leave because you're considered a flight risk. Do you think he got permission to do so? The judge said he had seen plenty of people facing similar charges who bought firearms for friends and then took no responsibility for their actions. Mills, he said, had accepted responsibility. And again, a year of probation. That was last August. Milwaukee last year saw an increase in homicides. They were one of the U.S. cities around the country that did see an increase in violent crime. We've talked with Sheriff David Clark about this. Sheriff Clark doesn't think that the Second Amendment is the issue. He doesn't think that law-abiding citizens exercising their right to keep and bear arms is the issue that's driving violence in Milwaukee. People like Dontre Mills are a part of the problem. But so is a criminal justice system that, again, allows violent criminals out on the street with very little time served, as long as their crimes don't end up on the front page of the Journal Sentinel or they don't lead the nightly news there. That is a problem that is not specifically related to Milwaukee, but a problem that a lot of us face around the country. But Sheriff Clark will tell you there are some real law enforcement challenges there in that community. What, again, you won't find there in the police blotters are a lot of concealed carry holders committing these violent crimes. But, you know, Hillary Clinton's okay with Barbara Ford believing that. Yeah, she's fine with it, even though it's completely false to think that getting rid of concealed carry would somehow clean up the mean streets of Milwaukee. Hillary Clinton is fine. Nobody from the Hillary Clinton campaign reached out to Barbara Ford and said, hey, you know, listen, just want to let you know. We did some checking. There actually weren't any arrests of concealed carry holders for any of these violent crimes. So, you know, just keep that in the back of your mind. Now, I think Hillary's okay with the idea of people thinking that concealed carry leads to the Wild West. Again, another argument that we have been hearing for decades, going back to Florida in the 80s, when the violent crime rate, by the way, was rising before concealed carry went into effect. State did kind of resemble the Wild West. And again, it wasn't because of law-abiding gun owners. And we heard that argument. I remember 2004 when we first signed on at NRA News, Ohio's concealed carry law went into effect. And a round of op-eds, it's going to be the Wild West. I remember one very distinctly saying that there were going to be shootouts in Blockbuster parking lots over parking spaces. Now, we don't even have Blockbuster video stores anymore. But we still have concealed carry in the state of Ohio. And there's been, again, no serious or unserious attempt in the state of Ohio to undo the concealed carry law. It just hasn't happened, nor has it happened in any other state that has adopted shall issue concealed carry. Not even in the last state of Illinois, which resisted for so long the idea that the right to keep and bear arms really, really meant something. Not even in Illinois have you had a serious attempt or an unserious attempt to repeal concealed carry. Just checking on the violent crime rate in Ohio real quick. 2004, 338 violent crimes. Round up, 339. Down to 285. Homicide from 4.6 per 100,000 to 4 per 100,000. Forcible rapes dropping from 41.4 to 35.3. Robberies down across the board. Index violent crimes are down in Ohio after the passage of concealed carry. It's not the mild West, it's the wild West, it's the mild Midwest. All right, stick around. We got to take a time out. We'll be back with much more. NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. Gentlemen, welcome to NRA News.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Tell me, what is AmericanSnipers.org all about?
We're a nonprofit, totally volunteer. Nobody makes any money. But basically what we do is we raise money, we buy gear, and we send it to military snipers overseas to do the business that needs to be done.
And how did you start this?
In 2003, we're basically police snipers from around the country. There's a big, I guess, the community's very tight, but there's a wide spread of us. And a couple of us were being deployed as reservists and National Guard. As snipers, they were also police snipers, and they needed gear that they didn't have available. So we put that together, started this little project, raised a little bit of money, and then realized there was a big need. And that was 2003. We've since grown legs, and here we are 14 years later, still raising money, sending gear to snipers in country.
So, Ron, going from where you guys started in 2003 to now, what's the trip been like? How has it grown? What's happened?
Well, it's been quite an adventure for us, but a lot of the needs have not really changed. The sniper units only have so much money, so once that money runs out, the guys are doing without. So we're still providing things, mostly sniper-specific gear, like rangefinders, spotting scopes, rifle scopes, gun cleaning gear, binoculars, that kind of thing. And it's the type of gear, like Dave said, when guys are getting deployed, they would call back home and they're asking mom and dad, hey, can you pick me up a wind meter? Well, folks don't generally know where to get that kind of stuff, but we do. So that's why they come to us, and we're able to get them their specific gear that they need.
Speak with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org. All right, so you guys start this. It's a no-brainer to me. It's a great idea and a great service you're all doing. What's the reaction rolling this out in the sniper community?
We have, when people know what we're doing, all they want to do is help. And where they can help us is we raise money. We sell swag. We sell coins and little trinkets. People give and donate. The manufacturers will donate. But for the most part, people hear about it and they go, that's awesome. I'm upset we have to do that, but yeah, we want to help them.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, David. Ron, what do you guys think about, and I don't want to get political, but what do you think about that? It's got to be frustrating to officers to know that sometimes they can't get the support they need to get the equipment that they need.
I don't think that's ever going to change. I think as long as we have a bureaucracy that has budgets and budgets get tight, we're not going to always be able to get the things we need. We know that as police officers. We know that as the military. There's priorities, and the bottom line is, as American citizens, we're going to support our military, and when people recognize that and we can broad stroke share that, they want to be part of that.
That's cool. Once again, speaking with David Agata and Ron Sasaki with AmericanSnipers.org, you know, there's a lot of folks who don't understand what it is, the mindset, the mentality, the life of a sniper, whether it's a military or police. Ron, what can you tell people about how can they understand best what you guys are, what you go through, you know, help get inside your head?
Well, it's just a very specialized thing that we do. It's something that people volunteer for, but you also have to have the right mindset and the determination and the professionalism to go through that. It's not for everybody, and not everybody gets to do it, but it's a very special thing, and guys who earn that spot, we try and help them out by doing what we do.
All right, it's a big sacrifice. Yeah, normally, military police, you're sacrificing.
Right, so give us an idea of some of the people that you've helped and who've benefited from AmericanSnipers.org.
Out naming names, it's been hundreds of guys in all different branches of the service. So we're at events like this. We get approached by people and said, hey, in 2004, you sent us a bunch of gear. You really helped us out. We hear from parents. So that's what we get out of it. That's what we find fulfilling.
Gentlemen, I bet you that never gets old either, right?
No,
not at all.
Not at all. Not at all. And then some of the gear that we get or we get donated, we get to give that back to the manufacturers. We had a company that donated some knives.
Tell folks how they get more information about AmericanSnipers.org.
Well, you can go to our website at www.AmericanSnipers.org, and that's where they can donate. We always have gun raffles going on constantly of some pretty high-end guns that we get donated to us.
David, Ron, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being part of NRA News.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome back. Thanks again for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. You know, we told you yesterday on the program about Incirlik Air Force Base in Turkey and the military dependents who were being mandatorily evacuated from Incirlik, as well as several hundred American families belonging to diplomatic staff. They're all leaving now because of the deteriorating security situation in Turkey. In a possibly related move, the threat here seems to be more Russia than ISIS. But the United States is moving more troops into Eastern Europe. The BBC says it is the most significant U.S. reinforcement of NATO since tensions flared over Russian action in Ukraine. Three fully manned U.S. combat brigades will be deployed. Last month, the Pentagon announcing plans to quadruple its budget for European defense in 2017. Did you remember that story, Cameron? Do you remember the Pentagon saying, hey, we want to quadruple the budget for European defense next year?
No.
That seems like a kind of big story. I wonder what, were we talking about Marco Rubio's shoes that day? What was the circus topic du jour?
And also, at the same time, when we're talking about Turkey, there's a lot of stuff going on with the Kurds, and you're seeing some possible action between Turkey and the Kurds. in a different part of Turkey. And yeah, you're right. We're focusing on such nonsense over here. There's real bad things going on around the world, and I would bet you that most of the quote unquote low information voters don't even know about the upping of the troops to Iraq. I would imagine people don't know this stuff, and we're so focused now.
Well, to be fair, the administration intentionally tried to downplay the upping of troops to Iraq.
Of course, you know. Of course. But the news is out there. People really wanted to find it.
That is true. But again, I mean, you really have to find it. You know, it's interesting. Jake Tapper said yesterday on Twitter that Barack Obama was not the best messenger to call for a more aggressive journalism. I told Jake that was awfully polite of him. He said he's a polite person. And there was apparently a very polite takedown of the president on Jake Tapper's show yesterday on CNN. Again, talking about how difficult it is to get information from the most transparent administration in history. And you can look at, again, the reports of over 5,000 troops now back in Iraq. The official number is about 3,800, but it's really over 5,000. They're able to fudge the numbers a little bit because of how these troops get rotated in and out of the country. And this is something that the White House has very much been downplaying, doesn't want to talk about this. Again, the president wants to be remembered for getting troops out of Iraq, not for getting troops out of Iraq and then slowly and surreptitiously putting more troops back in as his presidency was winding down because the threat from ISIS had increased. That's not the legacy that he wants. And so the messaging from the White House it will be to not talk about the real number of troops that are over there. And the most transparent administration in history all of a sudden looks very untransparent because it's being untransparent. You're right. Jake was right. The president, not the best messenger to deliver this message. But more than not being the best messenger is why he was not the best messenger, because this administration has done as much as possible to obfuscate what it does. It has done everything that it can do to try to minimize the power of the independent press. It has tried to make the White House press corps much more compliant and pliant. You want an interview with somebody off the record? Sure. But you got to report what we want you to report. You wrote bad things about the president. See if you ever get a sit down with the president again. And again, this is happening. The correspondents that work in the White House will tell you that this is happening. That there is a bit of pay to play that goes on. But you haven't seen anybody really speak out against it. In fact, you've seen far more journalists take jobs within the administration than you have seen journalists speak out against how the administration treats journalists. Right? So while the president is not the ideal messenger, I'm not sure that there are too many members of the watchdog press that are the ideal messengers as well. And if you're going to take the president to task, are you also going to take your fellow journalists to task for how they've behaved, how they would continue to behave in a Hillary Clinton presidency? Are you kidding me? And I don't think, look, I like Jake Tapper as much as I like anybody else on TV, except for the exception of Mike Rowe. Kind of have a man crush on Mike Rowe. But if he's going to talk about President Obama, he should also probably mention the problems within the media, because it is a two-way street. You know, again, the media has quietly complained about this. You've seen a column or two written over the years. Periodically, you'll see somebody say, oh, this White House is just, it's worse than you would think. But that's as far as it goes. So they're complicit as well, unfortunately. And they are certainly complicit, again, in the clown show media. They are the clown show media, who are more interested in showing us two people yelling at each other over something silly that'll be forgotten about in a week. And again, stories like the budget, the Pentagon budget for Eastern Europe increasing 400% next year. flies under the radar. Almost 1,000 U.S. citizens leaving Turkey because of the deteriorating military situation. Flies under the radar. Here's another story that'll fly under the radar. We've only got about 30 seconds left here. Kim Jong-un, North Korea, telling its citizens to prepare to eat roots again. This is not some sort of fad diet. This is the North Korean state telling its citizens, get ready. There's a famine coming. Why would there be a famine? Has the harvest been horrible? No. But the food's not available to the people because the food's being sold. For what? Probably weapons for North Korea. Stick around. On that cheery note, Hour 1 of NRA News Cam and Company's in the books. Hour 2 straight ahead.
Jesse James Duff. Talking before the break about the VA scandal and scandals.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad that you're joining us on the program here because, you know, as Ed said, it's been 2 years now since the last scandal sort of erupted publicly.
The major one.
Right.
That got everybody's attention.
But has anything changed?
Okay, so, you know, I've been following this probably for over 4 years. And originally I was with Concerned Veterans for America, and we were big proponents of getting the VA overhauled. Okay, so over the period of time, we're trying to figure out why can't they fire these executives? Well, apparently they have this merit review board that after the VA even had recommended dismissal of various executives, it goes to this merit review board, and they're discarding all of this and basically saying, no, you got to reinstate their position. You either got to pay them back pay. And so now, God bless Secretary McDonald. I will say this for the first time. He's presented legislation in front of the Senate, he himself and the VA, to allow them to remove this process or to adjust this process, because what's happened is he's getting blatantly embarrassed. We had executives that were able to move to another location, get $400,000 in moving expenses. The VA inspected it, recommended removal, reduced them in position. This merit review board came back and said, oh, no. You got to pay them what they're worth in the position that they got. And it just was bad judgment. Bad judgment? $400,000? Now, Sharon Hillman, the queen who broke this all open, who basically up in Seattle, Washington, when she was up there, had ignored the veteran suicide rate. She was reporting lower numbers. And instead of removing her then, what do? They don't move them. They didn't move her out. They moved her up. She became the director of the VA in Phoenix, where all the secret waiting lists were happening, where people didn't realize they'd been waiting over a year to get treatment. 40 veterans died when they found out they weren't getting treatment. Well, guess what? All three charges, only one stuck because of this merit review board. Do you realize after they finally got her off the payroll, finally got her out of there, the only one she had to plead guilty to was accepting gifts from lobbyists? That's it. 40 veterans are dead. That got dismissed with the secret waiting list, all of this, and she won't even spend any time in prison. She's going to get about 5 weeks or 5 months of probation, something to that extent. I'm appalled. Appalled. Not held accountable on any level.
That's the problem with the single-payer system. Nobody's ever held accountable in a single-payer system.
And absolutely.
It's so frustrating. Cam and I were just venting over this. This is not a two-year-old problem. This is not a four-year-old problem. This is a decades-old problem. It was a campaign point in 2008. Both John McCain and Barack Obama were saying, oh, yeah, we need to reform the VA. John McCain's still in the Senate. Barack Obama is still president. Nothing has changed.
Yeah, and why is it they haven't repaired that merit review board before? Now, this is what I would say. I would caution everybody. This isn't just going on in the VA. This is going on everywhere. So what that tells you is that none of these executives throughout the SES system do get fired. So we're focusing on this VA, but it's going on in the Department of Energy. It's going on in education.
The other day we were talking about the similarities between this, because we were discussing the former head of the VA system in St. Louis, who ended up being removed. The facility had to be shut down on two separate occasions, I guess, for a patient well-being concerns, possibly exposed 5,000 VA patients to HIV. She asked for a transfer to the Philippines. That's where her family lives. So she got to go. Now she's overseeing the VA clinic in the U.S. Embassy in the Philippines, still making $160,000 a year.
Unreal.
As a government-paid condo.
Unreal.
Right? But you go back and you look at, like, Operation Fast and Furious.
Yeah.
Who got fired with Operation Fast and Furious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody.
Nobody.
U.S.
Nobody.
Attorney in Phoenix was allowed to resign, had mm-hmm. a going-away mm-hmm. party, got mm-hmm. Praised by... They give him a cake. You know, I mean, like, that's what happens when you screw up. You get a cake.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Antonia Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry. Also, Seton Motley from Less Government joining us on the program. Another one of those kind of big stories that you probably won't see anywhere. This is buried at the Hill right now. It was posted just about an hour ago. Former intelligence chairman, more foreign spies in the United States than ever. Yeah, again, to me that seems like that should be one of those stories that there's at least time for a reader on the national news for. Former Representative Mike Rogers of Michigan said in an address at the Heritage Foundation, there are more spies in the United States today from foreign nation states than at any time in our history, including the Cold War. And they're stealing everything, he said. If it's not bolted down, it's gone. And if it's bolted down, give them about an hour. They'll figure out how to get that, too. When asked for the source of his claim, the Hill says Rogers appeared to credit American intelligence agencies. He said that's what the intelligence business is designed to do, is determine that we have individuals here who are engaged in espionage activities. It's massive, it's huge, and the numbers are overwhelming. He says that the proliferation of foreign intelligence operatives in the United States ought to serve as a warning to privacy and civil liberties advocates who have called for the Obama administration to rein in federal spying powers. He says, I'm not sure that we've adjusted quite correctly to the way that we are going to respond to those activities here in the United States. The Hill says in 2012, the former head of the CIA's secretive National Resources Division made a similar claim to CBS News. China, in particular, Hank Crumpton said, had, quote, very aggressive spying efforts focused on the United States. On Wednesday, Rogers attempted to distinguish China's spying efforts from those of Russia, another long-term U.S. adversary. He says Russia tends to send professional intelligence officers to scout the United States, while China instead turns to people who are, quote, not necessarily trained intelligence agents and officers. Those Chinese agents are sent for a very specific goal of stealing a very specific piece of intellectual property, he said, which makes them harder to detect. Oh boy. That's great news. And again, probably not something that's going to make the nightly news, right? Not unless there's a, what's the hook? Would be the question from the news director or the managing editor. So somebody gave a speech to the Heritage Foundation. So what? What's the hook? Has anybody been arrested? Have we uncovered a huge, gigantic spying ring? No? Well, we got something else to talk about. There's some sort of a political rally, I'm sure, that we could cover. There's something happened at a rally. Something happened. Some candidate said something somewhere, right? The big piece right now at the Hill, five things keeping Team Clinton on edge. Do you think one of those five things, Cameron, is the fact that apparently we have more foreign spies on U.S. soil than ever before? Do you think that is one of the things keeping Team Clinton on edge? How am I going to deal with this if I become president?
I don't think that's number 500.
Let's see. The Democratic race extends until July. That's probably going to happen. Money, money, money. Well, that's always on Hillary's mind. It's hard to unify Democrats, and the convention will be messy. That would apply. It's, you know, I will say this. It's nice to see the Hill recognizing that this is happening in both parties, not just one party. That this is happening within the country at large. In fact, this may not even be a symptom of problems within one party. This may be symptoms of larger problems that exist within our society. The FBI and the email controversy. Yeah, I could see why that would be weighing on Hillary Clinton's mind. I suppose that is a national security concern, of depending on how you look at it. And an ugly general election. So, no. Foreign intelligence, threat of ISIS, things like that. No, that's not really a concern right now for Team Hillary. I'm sure she'll be on it, though, if and when the time comes. I know that because she said so in an email that was on her private server. All right, as I mentioned, coming up this hour, Antonia Okafor will join us from Students for Concealed Carry, talking about the growing number of Texas colleges and universities that have issued their concealed carry policies, with campus carry going into effect
later this year. Also, Seton Motley of Less Government will join us on the program. We talked about Iowa last hour with Kurt Liske of the Iowa Firearms Coalition. Let's talk about Idaho as well. Permitless carry in the state of Idaho is making big advances here. It's Senate Bill 1389 in Idaho. Now, Idaho already has permitless carry outside of city limits. But Governor Butch Otter in Idaho signing legislation that applies that standard statewide here. So July 1st of this year, Idaho will become the eighth state to become a permitless carry, a constitutional carry state. Now, again, with all of these other states, the concealed carry license doesn't go away. There are, you know, a lot of Idahoans who, Idahoans? Idahoites? Who live there in the Boise area. That's where about a sixth of the population is. Many of them, you know, go back and forth between Idaho and Washington State on a regular basis. They're still going to have reciprocity with Washington if they want to leave the confines of the state of Idaho. We have seen in Arizona, for example, despite the passage of permitless carry, the number of concealed carry licenses has actually increased in the state. So it doesn't get rid of the system, but it does say to those folks, you do have that right to keep and bear arms. When West Virginia passed its permitless carry legislation earlier this session, we spoke with Delegate Sarah Blair, the youngest legislator in America right now, as a matter of fact. And, you know, one of the things that she talked about were the constituents that she had heard from, frankly, who have been hit fairly hard by the Obama economy. You know, when the president decides to declare war on coal and you're a coal state, there are consequences. And a lot of these folks say this is a relief to not have to continue to pay another fee to exercise a right. The Senate Bill 1389 ensures that the lawful carrying of firearms is, again, confined to the lawful carrying of firearms by those who are legally allowed to do so. And again, it'll go into effect on July 1st of this year. So congratulations, not just to Iowa, but to Idaho as well. Now, there have been critics of the legislation, as there always are. The Idaho Statesman, with a piece a couple of days ago, permitless carry bill, quote, sets Idaho up for failure. He says permitless carry doesn't allow you to carry on public university campuses. You need an Idaho enhanced permit to do that. There are a number of other places that you can't carry in the city, even with permitless carry, such as the post office. Don't be fooled into thinking that you can permitless carry everywhere, even when you can't. Well, no, as with every law, you need to actually look at the law and what it says. And, of course, you know, things like private property can still be posted by those who wish to do so. But, again, I got to say, I think all in all, this is a big step forward there in the state of Idaho. In Mississippi, the state Senate has approved a bill that would allow pastors to decide for themselves, or not just pastors, but leaders of a house of worship to decide for themselves what their policy will be regarding firearms in their place of worship. 36-14 was the vote for House Bill 786. It was the state Senate voting here on this House bill. So it now goes back to the House for a concurrence vote. Under the bill, according to ABC News, places of worship could designate members to undergo firearms training and carry guns to protect the congregation. Notably, It goes beyond church security and would allow people to carry guns and holsters without a state concealed weapons permit, a feature that drew opponents' criticism. That would expand on last year's state law allowing people to carry guns in purses or briefcases without a permit. Now, again, this allows for these churches to set their own policies. So you kind of have to wonder why there would be objections to this, given that anti-gun advocates want places to be able to set their own policies to ban guns, right? I mean, look at the campaign that Moms Demand Action has had against Starbucks and Sonic and Target and whatever else, right? They want those private spaces to have the ability to set their own policies, and they want that policy to be, don't bring your gun here. As it turns out, they're not so much in favor of, you know, property rights, but they're in favor of our gun bans. And so if right now something is prohibited, a pastor cannot even allow this. If the pastor would like to allow this, they're okay with that. That's fine with them. They're not concerned about the property rights then. ABC News, quoting Chris Cox, there is also a section of the bill that would lower requirements, ABC says, for concealed carry permits. Chris Cox says that this important piece of program legislation clarifies existing law in Mississippi and ensures that each Mississippian has the right to carry their firearm in the manner that best suits them. A debate, ABC News says, also erupted over whether federal regulations could override Mississippi's constitution. In what way? Just out of curiosity. To scattered applause from fellow senators, ABC says, a lawmaker told a Democratic counterpart, Hob Bryan of Amory, that he believed the Mississippi Constitution couldn't be trumped without a law passed by Congress. Bryan said, you may have been wrong before, but you've never been more wrong than you are now. ABC News says federal courts have ruled that rules enacted by agencies, even if not laws passed by Congress, override state law. But they didn't say what exactly that that conflict would come from. The news agency says that when it came to the discussion of, again, allowing places of worship to set their own policies regarding the carrying of firearms, allowing people to choose for themselves, one of the opponents of that measure, ABC News describes him as a soft-spoken Senator Hillman Frazier, Democrat from the capital city of Jackson, spoke while brandishing a sheathed sword before the chamber. He cited the story of Jesus healing the high priest's servant after a disciple cut off the servant's ear as Jesus was being arrested. Hillman Frazier said, we don't need to pimp the church for political purposes. If you want to pass a law or pass a bill liberalizing gun laws, then do that. Don't use the church. Well, it seems to me like that's kind of what the bill is about, not about politicizing the issue, which, again, seems to be done by the anti-gun activists here. But, again, there's an issue. I guarantee you that there are pastors in Mississippi who would love to have the ability to, again, set that policy themselves rather than being told by state law you don't have that right. Right? Now, as for the scripture that the senator cited, he did not speak about Luke 22:36, in which Jesus told the disciples, but now take your money. If you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. Why would he have wanted the disciples to have a sword, if not for self-defense, if not to protect themselves so that the message could live on? Maybe just for decoration, because it looked cool. Maybe that's what he was thinking. I kind of doubt that, though. And again, around the country, you know, we've talked with pastors from around the country. We've reported on stories where, sadly, you know, again, the church is not a sanctuary from violence. And pastors, members of the security team at church have had to defend themselves and the parishioners there. Again, this is not an empty intellectual argument about property rights and who decides what their policy should be. This is about real individuals being able to protect those in their care. And those real individuals being told right now, out of your hands. It's about giving them that choice. And again, there is one side here who doesn't want there to be a choice. They want the answer to always be no. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. We will let you know. We'll keep following what's going on there in Mississippi. Again, the state Senate passing House Bill 786. 36 to 14, so it goes back to the House for a concurrence vote, but hopefully that is more of a formality. This will be on to the governor's desk here before long, and we'll keep our eyes on this measure. But when we come back, we're going to turn our attention to campus carry. There are a number of universities and colleges in the state of Texas that have now issued their concealed carry regulations, and we'll talk about it with Antonia Okafor from Students for Concealed Carry on Campus right after this quick timeout. Stick around. We'll be back with more right after this.
Speaking with Bill Poole, he is Managing Director, NRA Education and Training Division. Bill, let's talk about the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course. I understand some of it's now available online. Tell us about it.
Yes, John. It's called blended learning. That means that part of the course is online. It's about a 7.5-hour online training section that students can complete in the comforts of their own home on their own schedule. And then once they've completed the online or the e-learning module, then they can contact an NRA-certified instructor who will take them to the range and check out their skills, make sure their safe gun handling is at its top, and that their marksmanship skills is just as good as it needs to be.
So this is the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course, which is, Bill, such a great course and such a great thing. You guys have kind of jiggered things up a little bit there to make it easier for people to do, right?
It is easier, but I don't want anybody to think that that means that it's shorter or less comprehensive. It's about 7.5 hours of seat time when you take the e-learning module, and then about another 5 hours of time when you go shooting. But the good news is the shooting portion can be all done in one day and half a day, and so it's going to meet the needs of our students' schedules much better than we've been able to do in the past.
I love it. So then get the book learning part done, then get out there to the range with an NRA-certified instructor and finish it all up. It's a great idea, this blended learning course. So, Bill, how can folks get more information about this? How can they sign up? How do they do it?
First step is go to our webpage. It's onlinetraining.nra.org, and I hope they all do it today.
Why should folks check out the NRA Basics of Pistol Shooting course?
It is one of the most vibrant, robust e-learning training courses they're ever going to encounter. There's video, there are 3D pictures. You can listen to it. You can read it. I mean, we've used every modality teachers know how to use. It's an excellent course.
Could have said it better myself, Bill Poole. Thank you so much, sir.
I'm a mom, a business owner, and a patriot, but I am not a politician. A few years ago, I founded a nonprofit to defend voters' rights and stop election fraud. We exposed corruption, so the corruptors wanted me silenced. The IRS, FBI, ATF, OSHA, and a U.S. congressman turned my life upside down. Their investigations were invasive, abusive, relentless, and political. They demanded every social media message I'd ever posted, the name of every group I'd ever spoken to, and every word I spoke. I was supposed to give up, but I am not a victim. I'm an American, and I will not stand by and watch while our freedoms are picked off. An attack on one right is an attack on every right. So, I fight. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I'm a mom, and just like millions of other women, that's why I own guns. We're responsible, we're law-abiding, and we're everything that makes America strong. Every day, we're willing to use a firearm to defend our families. But the media will never tell those stories. If a mom puts a gun to the face of a home-invading thug and makes him run for his life, the story gets buried. But if she's unarmed and murdered, the cameras will be at the scene before the police. It's time for moms like me to speak out. We are the majority. We demand the freedom to defend our families. And we challenge the media to tell the truth about our rights. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It's NRA News, Cam and Company. I thought for sure we'd be playing the Beatles, You Say It's Your Birthday. And Tony Ogle from Students for Concealed Carry with us on the program right now. And Tony, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am good. And happy NRA birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm excited.
I'm excited as well. Congratulations. Welcome to the organization. We're going to get to see you in Louisville, right? Is this going to be your first annual meeting, too?
Yes, this will be my first annual meeting, so I'm really excited to kind of have a CPAC, too, right?
Oh, no. Oh, Antonia, if you only knew. CPAC is cool, don't get me wrong, but imagine CPAC times 10, maybe?
Oh, man.
Maybe times 12? Oh, yeah, it's... I want to be there. I want to be there when you walk into the exhibit hall for the very first time, because I want to be the one to take a picture of the smile on your face.
Well, if you time it just right, I'm sure we can get that picture, that photo off.
All right, fantastic. In the meantime, it looks like there are some things to smile about and maybe some things to be concerned about in some of the concealed carry policies that we're seeing from universities around the state of Texas, right? I mean, we've talked about UT Austin before, but you folks at Students for Concealed Carry, you all are pointing out we're getting a lot of these universities that are now coming forward with their the implementation of the campus carry policies.
Right. It's kind of, it's basically a policy season. Can I coin that term, I guess? yeah. So they're all coming out now with their policies. And thankfully, you know, we've been, a lot of attention has been with UT Austin. And we kind of just, you know, decided, well, let's talk about the ones that are doing it correctly. And, that's been UT, Tyler. So University of Texas at Tyler and Texas State University. They've kind of actually from the beginning have been very cooperative. We've had people on the task force, those who are actually making the policies, reach out to us and ask us questions on what should happen, different things they should be doing. So from the get-go, they were very cooperative and wanting to get our input. So this is what happens when you do that. You have policies that follow the intent of the law.
It is possible to do so then without crafting, multi-point and sub-points compare, because again, we've talked about UT Austin, compare like their policies to the policies at UT Tyler or Texas State or some organization where there's been that communication, there's been that back and forth. What's the difference in how these final policies look like?
Sometimes it's just night and day. I mean, there are so many to go around and to talk about, but the ones that we're still talking about with UT Austin and have an issue with are that requiring semi-automatic handguns to have an empty chamber and that professors have the leeway to make their offices gun-free zones at will. So that's what UT Austin is doing. That's the two big ones that we have a problem with.
So those policies are not in place at like UT Tyler or Texas State?
No. So really, they focused on what is important and when it comes down to it, the ones that we haven't really said anything much about when it comes to having child care areas, areas where there might be a court or some type of legal process taking place. several different ones, but really, and it comes down to it, they are following the intent of the law and what the original meaning of the law means for students on campus. There's these other schools that have gone kind of left field and added all these different things to it that have nothing to do with keeping our rights on campus.
All right. Now, what about places like University of North Texas and Texas Tech? Because there, it looks like you all have some issues with some of the policies that we haven't necessarily talked about before.
Right. So we've already spoken with them, or rather, we've already kind of warned them about their policies, particularly the one that has to do with not allowing carry, concealed carry during ticketed events. So particularly what we're concerned about with that, and that's not sport events. Most of them, for example, Texas Tech has said even performances, that they have some ballet or any type of art performance, that is within the grounds of, you know, banning concealed carry in those places. I believe specifically they've said if there's 200 students, 200 participants or more. And so that's where we're concerned with, because we feel that there's already been precedent of having a place where even there's alcohol, to say Austin City Limits, this is huge, which would, because it's municipal grounds, they allow concealed carry on there. So we feel that why is it that if you're going to go to a movie theater someplace else, anywhere else other than, you know, UNT in this case, why is it different when you go onto a UNT movie theater that you're not able to have a concealed license there? So that's what we're just seeing, is this disparity of allowing people to safely and legally carry in different venues that are exactly the same, and then going on campus and not allowing that same student to have the same right.
You know, and again, it does seem to come back to that argument of, well, campuses are special, Antonia, even though, you know, clearly the intent of this legislation was that, no, campuses aren't special. Right as a concealed carry holder extends onto these places as well. And, you know, it's really interesting that you point out Austin City Limits, because we've seen, and you're well aware of this as much as I am, we have seen no shortage of these imaginary horror stories, right, of what could happen if these college students, who are all just drunken morons, if they're able to carry on a college campus. Oh, my gosh, I mean, these places are just saturated with alcohol. Now, you know, and I know that this is, you know, lunacy, that we're talking about people who are over the age of 21. They can legally drink. They can also legally carry a firearm. They cannot do both at the same time. And people don't do both at the same time. So here we have this huge festival in Austin, right? Every year, tens of thousands of people go to the Austin City Limits. This is on my bucket list to go to one year. And as you say, alcohol is served there. It is on municipal property, so concealed carry is allowed. And there have not been problems with the two of those things taking place in the same physical space, because concealed carry holders are law-abiding, responsible gun owners, regardless of where they are.
Exactly. And that's what it comes down to. But it seems that this logic and reasoning and facts... this is too scary for them. So, I mean, you know, being someone who's local, I know UNT is basically another UT Austin. So when it comes to the demographic of people that we're dealing with on campus, it's definitely no Texas A&M, where, you know, the chancellor hasn't said that they don't, you know, they're going to follow the law regardless of, you know, what people say, because they tend to be more pro-campus carry than other universities. So it's not really surprising coming from UNT and these other campuses, but it's still concerning and still something that we're going to have to fight and continue to deal with as we go on with this policy process.
Has Texas A&M issued their policies yet?
No, they said they will do it in April because they're going to do all of their campuses at one time, just under one system. But we have a fairly we're pretty optimistic about what they're going to be bringing forth. So,
all right, well, in the meantime, I know that more of these universities and colleges will be coming out with their policy proposals. Are these measures that we've seen introduced at places like University of North Texas, Texas Tech University, are these policies set in stone now, or do they still have to be approved by Board of Regents? Is there still time for input by the community to hopefully change these policies?
Right, and that's what we're with UT Austin particularly. It's the president has signed off, but it still has to go to the Board of Regents, and that's where we're using this time to get as many people to put input into making sure that these policies are changed so we don't have to go to the litigation process where it's heading right now. So until the Board of Regents signs off and says yes to them, it's not official until then, but there's a lot of work to be done before that happens.
You know, I'm curious as well, Antonio, before we let you go here, because obviously, you know, we've seen gun-free UT, we've seen the professors there at UT Austin say, I'm leaving, I'm not going to teach here anymore, a couple of them anyway. I haven't seen any professors at Texas A&M say this. I haven't seen anything from the University of Texas at Tyler or at Texas State University. Is it that those professors on those campuses, they're not being covered? Or is it that a lot of media attention is being focused on the very few voices, particularly those at UT Austin, who are very vocally speaking out against this measure?
Oh, yeah. And that's what frustrates us as well, frustrates me. Like I told you before, I mean, the media, when they want to talk to us, who they want to talk to are people from UT Austin's campus, even though, you know, this is affecting all of Texas,
right?
All public universities. You could say to an extent private universities, they don't opt out as well. And so the focus has been UT Austin, and which it tends to be a very liberal-leaning campus, which with liberal-leaning professors who are also very outspoken. And so these professors that are pro-campus carry that, you know, we've had a hard time having them even to come out because they feel like they might be ostracized from the community. And it's just it's a hostile environment for those people. But I'm sure there are liberal professors that, you know, even at Texas A&M, I'm sure they're somewhere. But in the end, it comes to the campus culture. And then where the media likes to focus is also going to be something that's perpetuated in public opinion. So the media has an involvement in this as well, and where they focus their attention.
Absolutely. Listen, Antonio, I appreciate you coming on the program. It is always a pleasure talking with you. Congratulations again on your NRA membership. And we look forward to talking again very soon.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Antonio Oka for joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company with Students for Concealed Carry. Always happy to celebrate someone's NRA birthday. In Tennessee, they are going to be voting on a campus carry measure here before long. State Senate going to get the bill after the Senate Judiciary Committee approved the measure on a 7-2 vote. Nashville Public Radio says college campuses are among the few places in Tennessee, I have to use my public radio voice, where people with handgun permits are still barred by law from carrying. Gun rights advocates, Nashville Public Radio says, like NRA lobbyist Aaron Looper, say that has made college campuses a prime target for criminals. Looper told legislators Tuesday, it really does make law-abiding citizens almost sitting ducks. That argument annoys State Senator Lee Harris, Democrat from Memphis. He says that it suggests people who choose not to carry guns are to blame when they are victimized by violent crimes. Shouldn't they have the right to keep guns away, he asked. You know, look, here's the thing. Take a look at Kansas's campus carry law. It goes into effect in August of next year. Now, that law says that college campuses can declare their campuses to be off limits to guns, but they have to provide security, since, again, you're not going to be able to protect yourself. They have to be able to provide security there at the entrance to every building. University of Kansas said, well, that's going to cost a lot of money. That's going to cost about $37 million. We can't afford to do that, even though, again, their endowment is $1.8 billion with a B. So if State Senator Lee Harris is serious about this argument, well, where's your proposal? where is your proposal to actually keep guns away rather than say our policy is to not allow guns on campus? Because you know what? As far as actually keeping guns away, that doesn't work for squat. So are you proposing a policy or are you actually proposing a plan to keep guns away? Because I'm thinking it's more empty rhetoric. I'm thinking that Senator Harris is not actually proposing any additional spending on measures to increase campus security. Instead, what we get, instead of a plan, what we get is this, again, argument, this absurd argument that recognizing the right of self-defense is somehow victim-blaming for people who are the victims of violent crime who did not have a firearm. Again, that is absurd. That is absolutely and utterly absurd. Promoting the right of self-defense for all those who choose to exercise it. And by the way, in whatever form that may take, whether it's carrying a firearm, whether it's carrying a taser, whether it's knowing jujitsu, whatever form you are comfortable taking to protect yourself, exercising that choice does not mean that all of a sudden you are automatically blaming the victims of violent crime who did not go to jujitsu class, who did not buy a firearm. If anything, the crime victims that I know who have become advocates for self-defense, including owning a firearm for self-defense, they're not interested in blaming anybody. They're interested in having fewer victims overall. Blame doesn't really enter their equation. It's interesting that that's the argument that's brought up by Senator Harris. All right, we're going to take a quick break here on NRA News, Cam and Company. I've got some crime victims that Senator Harris could talk to. Guests on this program, I'll be happy to try to facilitate those discussions if the senator would like. Seton Motley of Less Government is going to come up in just a couple minutes. We've got the Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense at the top of the hour. Deal of the Day, good guy as well. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Right now, you know, we have a good guy segment on the program each and every day. Well, here is a real-life good guy. Major Ed Polito is with us from the Folds of Honor Foundation. Major, it's good to see you again, sir.
Man, what a great day to be an American.
Yes, yeah. Sir. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm just excited. Look, at when you get to come here, this is freedom right here.
Right.
And you get to see all of the great things that are, all the great people, all the great items that are here, and certainly the hardware, man. I tell you what, it doesn't get better than that, and this is about the USA, baby.
Yeah,
in
right.
Vegas.
That's right. So tell me, for folks who haven't been able to catch you on the program before, those few Americans out there who still are unaware of the Folds of Honor Foundation, what does this organization do?
Well, the Folds of Honor Foundation was started by Major Dan Rooney, and as a co-founder of the organization, I've been with Major Dan on this mission for about 8 years. We give scholarships to the families that have fallen and wounded. But we've awarded over 10,000 scholarships. This year, we'll probably do another 2,500 to deserving military families, honoring the sacrifice, educating the legacy, and providing healing and support for these wounded service members that come back and are disabled and that they need that hope and that support. And I think, you know, NRA News has been with us from day one. And, you know, we've got so many great sponsors that are part of it. Here just in the show, you know, Colt Bushnell, got 511 Tactical down there. We're going to do a book signing at 2:30 this afternoon at the 511 Tactical booth, and we're just spreading the message about freedom and sacrifice and the Folds of Honor.
You know, and it's so important, especially for those of us who never wore the uniform and we never served. We have, I think, an obligation to help those who have. And, you know, I never wore the uniform, but my dad was in the Navy in World War II. My brother was in the Army during Desert Storm, was in Korea at the time. And I've lived around military families, and I've gotten to see firsthand not only how the soldier or the sailor or the airman
how they are impacted, but how their entire families are making sacrifices each and every day. And when we're talking about our wounded warriors, you know, those families, they're going through so much that it's easy for us to forget. Right, we don't see the news stories every day anymore about our soldiers in Iraq or Afghanistan. In fact, our special ops guys, you know, they work very quietly, and
Correct.
So we're not supposed to see the headlines, but they're there, and they are serving, and we need to serve them. So, what can we do to get involved with Folds of Honor?
Well, people can go to foldsofhonor.org and get involved. They can also do a lot of buy the products that we have out here. The other thing I will tell you is that as you serve this great nation, and as I put on the nation's uniform, lost my leg, almost lost my life, I always think about, you know what, I did what I did to preserve freedom in this nation. And for all of us in this nation to have everything that we've got, to live and have a great quality of life. And you just explained that to us, to your listenership. You know, it's about honoring that sacrifice, but more importantly, about making sure that around the world that they know the United States of America is nobody to be messing around with. Because at the end of the day, our people stand up for freedom.
Now, okay, so to that end, I want to ask you something as Major Ed Polito, not with the Folds of Honor Foundation, but just Major Ed Polito for a second. How concerned are you that that America's enemies are starting to get a different message, that maybe we can be pushed around a little bit?
Well, I got to tell you that we cannot sit around and let people push us around. And I am a big advocate. In my book, Warrior for Freedom, I wrote about Ronald Reagan and his message to the world that, you know what, not only are you going to tear that wall down, but if you do something and you get out of line, we're going to bust you up. And I got to tell you, that's the way I look at things. You know, we cannot sit around in this world that's so negative with ISIS doing what they're doing. And then, of course, them kind of infiltrating our country and then this refugee problem and all of this. And our leadership, our poor leadership, not understanding that at the end of the day, it's not about saying that individuals can't come here and follow the American dream. It's about making sure that when you come here, you learn not only our language, our customs, but you live as an American. And I got to tell you, the culture, I'm Colombian and Puerto Rican. My father was an immigrant. I truly understand that the red, white, and blue shines bright because people like him, a Vietnam-era vet, took that oath of office to love his country, to love his family, and to have faith in God. And I think that's the elements of who we are in this nation.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Katie Moyer, political writer, talking about the Cosmopolitan next hour. Stephen Cruz of PJ Media had a Tennessee resident on Twitter just now send me a picture of a lawmaker there. Says they're real hard workers. Not a shining example of logic and hard work. Looks like a legislator playing solitaire there on his phone. Huh. Well, I suppose there are worse things they could be doing on the internets there while they're at work. Seton Motley of Last Government is with us on the program. He, I'm sure, has some horror stories of lawmakers caught doing things they're not supposed to be doing while they're there on the in the well of the legislature. How are you, Seton?
I'm fine. My favorite, of course, is in the 1800s when a congressman, a member of the House of Representatives, shuffled off to the Senate and beat a guy nearly to death with a cane.
Yeah, that would be violating the Roberts Rules of Order, I would think. Right?
I'm not sure if there's any kind of like Harvard debate tactic that's being violated.
That escalated quickly, by the way. I mentioned playing solitaire on your phone. You went to a grievous bodily harm.
That's always on top of mind because everyone's saying, oh my gosh, this is the worst the political climate's ever been in the history of the United States. I'm like, no, because no one's getting beaten to death with a cane.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's not the worst that it's ever been. That does overstate things. People forget, which is really sad when you think about it, because we just got through with the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. I might add, by the way, that our president did not acknowledge things like Gettysburg or the real end to major hostilities. Never went to the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg, didn't go to the 150th anniversary of Appomattox, didn't attend the 150th.
The guy who claimed Lincoln was his idol.
Yeah, didn't show up. So, you know, we did not have, I think, that cultural recognition and that reminder, that very periodic reminder of, hey, here's how bad it can get.
Right.
You know, we did
right.
sort of gloss over that a little bit, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, the you know, I had to look it up again because I can't remember the congressman or the senator's name, but it was related to slavery. It was in the 1850s, I believe. And it was related to, I believe, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, if I'm remembering properly, but I'm not sure.
Okay, I'm enough of a history geek that I can tell you is Preston Brooks, who was wielding the cane.
The cane, right. Brooks
and
was the cane guy, right.
I believe it was Charles Sumner? Was
Sumner,
that right?
That's right. That's what I was about to say. So, Sumner was a senator, and he didn't die, but he it took over a year for him to even reappear in the Senate, and even then he was never close to being the same.
Right. In the meantime, Preston Brooks, who had apparently beaten Sumner so hard that his cane broke, got cane sent to him from all around. Well, not all around.
Yeah,
country.
He got replaced with cane sent.
Yeah.
By supporters.
Yeah.
And it was, wasn't it slavery related? Wasn't it about?
It was. It was 1856.
Yeah.
The speech became known as the Crime Against Kansas.
Kansas-Nebraska Act, right?
Yep. And,
yeah.
And he attacked, South Carolina, verbally attacked South Carolina Senator Andrew P. Butler, who was a cousin of Preston Brooks, who was a congressman. He was over on the House side. And so I think it was about a week or so later, Sumner was sitting at his desk. Preston Brooks came in, with his cane, proceeded to, beat the snot out of, Senator Sumner, who couldn't get up from his desk, actually, apparently ended up wrenching the desk out. It was bolted, you know, to the Senate floor. And he ended up, in his attempt to get away, wrenching the desk off the floor. I mean, it was a, you know, not one of our proudest moments in American political history.
But you're
right. When you talk about how bad things can get and how vitriolic things can get, you know, in a lot of ways, Seton, we are spoiled. We just are. I was thinking about this today. If you were born after 1955, you never really had to worry about being drafted, because there was never an active military draft. Sure, you know, you may have grown up in the shadow of the Cold War and thinking about Russian paratroopers, you know, dropping down onto your playground and things like that.
Cuban Missile Crisis and all that.
Right. Matthew Broderick taking over a computer at NORAD and launching World War III. But, you know,
but see, at that point in the early 80s, it had already migrated to Hollywood fiction.
Exactly. I mean, we are really, really blessed, lucky, privileged, spoiled, whatever word you want to use. There are, you know, most of humanity would gladly trade places with us.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And
which is why we had to have an immigration policy, because of the 6 billion people on the planet, 5.9 billion would want to be here.
Not to mention all of those human beings that have come before us who would love to swap places. You go back to live in, you know, 14th century Bulgaria. I'll gladly take Omaha in 2016, right?
I'll take Congress in 1954, 1854. Yes.
So, right. I just think it's worth remembering that and realizing that every now and then.
Yes.
All right.
And please be again, it was Charles Sumner. And what was the cane wielder's name?
Preston Brooks.
Preston Brooks. Okay, good. I'm going to remember that. Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. Now let's talk about your piece. I'm always happy to talk a little history, by the way. So,
yes.
Let's talk about your piece. Intellectual property protection is a fundamental free market tenant, not a tax. Who sees intellectual property protection as a tax right now?
There was a very well-read piece on truthout.org's website by Dean Baker. His name was Dean Baker or David Baker. I don't remember at the moment, but it was D. Baker. But anyway, he wrote this piece, and the headline was something along the lines of, everyone's complaining about Trump's 45% tariffs, me included, by the way, if I added parenthetically. But what about the 10,000% tariffs that are possible? And what he meant by that was what he calls government monopolies, government-mandated monopolies, intellectual property, patents, trademarks, copyrights, etc. He calls those tariffs on what could otherwise be lower prices on goods and services. And I just, first of all, that's a bastardization of the language. That's not a tax. intellectual property is productive people and their productions being protected by government. A tax is unproductive government taking money from productive people to use for unproductive programs. So that's the first thing. Second of all, he points to a drug that costs, you know, so much for a 3-month cycle that it can be made for $200 a month in Jakarta or whatever. And this is one of my pet peeves and one of my annoyances. Yeah, the second pill costs $200 for 3 months. The first pill cost $8 billion. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of really expensive people spent a lot of time and a lot of lab work and a lot of experimentation producing a lot of drugs that didn't do anything for anybody. And then finally, the 15th or 16th or 22nd iteration, their 30th attempt at it, finally works out. And they have a product they can bring to market. And they have to make up all that past failing research money on that successful pill. That's how research works. That's how research and development works. And to immediately undermine that by saying, oh, we can produce the pills now for $200 a month in Jakarta, why would anyone invest in the next big, you know, the next pill or the next plane or the next whatever if they're going to be immediately undercut by some thief in Jakarta or, you know, Nairobi or wherever?
Absolutely. I mean, as you say, taxes are taxes and are impediments to markets optimally functioning. Intellectual property protection, whether it's patents, copyrights, trademarks, those are not taxes. And intellectual property protection is crucial to markets even existing, let alone optimally functioning.
Yeah.
You know, but this is, I think this is part of the problem that we see right now, Seton, in so many different areas where we're not thinking things through. Right. I mean, not only this, you know, I think we have a big problem of not looking at the unintended consequences, but that's not even really what we're talking about here. Here it seems to be even more basic of we're just simply not thinking of, OK, well, if I do A, then what are the logical, what are the anticipated consequences of action A going to be? What, you know, what is B going to be?
Right. Well, you know, we run into this with taxes all the time. The assumption is, you know, if you raise taxes, you'll raise X amount of revenue. And ignoring the fact that people who make money want to keep their money and will do other things. I remember your beloved producers, John Pop and Cameron Gray, used to work for G. Gordon Liddy, and he said, that analysis is static analysis. That's the same thing as saying, you see me rearing back to punch you, you're going to stand there and let me hit you. And, of course, dynamic analysis is, no, you're probably going to duck or move away or, you know, something like that. And why on earth would a creative person go to the effort and time and expense and all of that of creating something if they're immediately going to get ripped off for it once they do? And that's not just the creative people. A lot of creative people don't have a lot of money. They have ideas, but they don't have a lot of money. They have to go raise the money to actually investigate their idea and turn it into a product. That means the investors have to be protected too. And that's the whole underpinning of the entire intellectual property protection system is, okay, we're going to put our capital and time and effort at risk in exchange for this payout at the other end. And that's what the patent and trademark and copyright and all that stuff is geared to do. If you take that away, why would anyone, you know, why would anyone risk anything? Why would they waste their time? Why would they waste their money? And the answer is, of course, they would not. That's the old joke about socialism and capitalism. Socialism tries to root out human nature, and capitalism harnesses it. And this is completely ignoring human nature to say that you can immediately start, you know, replicating these pills. Yeah, that's going from one to two. The problem is going from zero to one. And if you don't have any incentive to go from zero to one, you never will go from zero to one. And, of course, you then can never go from one to two.
Talking again with Seton Motley. All right, Seton, listen, we've got about 60 seconds left here. I've got to ask you, when President Obama said in Argentina recently that there's no difference, right? Just six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Capitalism, communism, socialism—it doesn't really matter. Again, I think that's of what we're discussing, which is the ideas will just come; they'll magically rain down from heaven. No matter what the policies are, no matter how big the government is, it will still happen. And then you just partial it out in different ways depending upon what system you use. No. The systems in place, government intrusions actually affect product discovery and outcome.
There you go. Seton Motley, appreciate you coming on the program, sir, as always. And I look forward to doing this again.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Seton Motley with us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Coming up, top of the hour, we have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day as well, plus Katie Moyer, political writer, talking about that Cosmo video. Four women tell their boyfriends how they really feel about their guns, not one of them too keen about the idea that their boyfriends are gun owners. Katie, I think, might have a different impression. Cosmo didn't reach out to Katie, but we did. Stephen Cruiser, PJ Media, joining us on the program as well. Plus more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information for you. It is all coming up right after a quick timeout here on NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Joe Fiala with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. Joe, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
Hey, I'm great, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for stopping by. You got a lot of stuff going on. I wanted you to talk a little bit about what you do in the Governor's Office of Economic Development there in South Dakota and why you do it. So tell us a little bit about what the office is all about and what you have going on.
Sure. So we're all about growing business in the state or attracting business to the state. And in my specific instance, I get to work with all of the companies in the shooting, hunting, and outdoor industry. So everything from firearms and ammunition to duck calls and fishing rods.
Wow, Joe, can we say dream job here?
Yeah, you can.
And it's great in South Dakota. There's an office to do this. Because, you know, Joe, in some states would say, I won't mention names, you know, it's okay. Maybe we'll keep you at arm's length. We love your taxes. But you guys are showing in a very overt way here, welcoming industries like this.
Absolutely. You know, it's such a good fit for the state in a couple of ways. And here's a couple of examples. We've got about 850,000 people in the state. And we issued 350,000 hunting licenses last year.
Say that again. Hold on.
Yeah. So we've got about 850,000 people in the state, and we issued 350,000 hunting licenses.
Wow, dude, that is incredible.
Yeah. So this industry is a really good fit for the state. It's just culturally what we do, who we are.
Yeah, and you know, Joe, we're talking. Let's talk about that for a minute. I just was talking with some other folks here, and for people who are non-hunters and don't understand, it's part of a lifestyle, you know. It's part of, you know, who we are and what we do.
That's exactly right. You know, I grew up hunting with my dad and my mom, and we'd go out hunting, and now I get to teach my kids that same thing.
Right.
And it's about family time. It's about, you know, hunting for your table.
Yeah.
In some instances.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's about the sportsmanship.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, Joe, whether you grew up, I grew up in Pennsylvania. Hunting's big there. The day after Thanksgiving, when I grew up, it wasn't about going out Black Friday and shopping. It was going out deer hunting.
Exactly.
Or you grew up in South Dakota. That's just part of what our DNA is. Speaking with Joe Fiala, he is with the South Dakota Governor's Office of Economic Development. So tell us a little bit about some of the stuff, some of the folks you've been working with. Name some of the companies.
Right. So, you know, some of the South Dakota companies that have been longtime residents that continue to grow. You know, you hear Dakota Arms.
Right.
Certainly. Black Hills Ammunition.
Absolutely.
Corbin Ammunition. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've got some of the players that have been around a long time. One of our newest corporate citizens to the state is a company out of Pennsylvania. It's called Lehigh Defense.
Okay,
I've heard of them. Yep. They are expanding to the state. And so it's a great fit. They're going to make bullets, and we'll use them.
How great is that? A company in Pennsylvania is expanding out to South Dakota.
Right.
How great is that?
Right.
All right, so we got about 30 seconds here, and then we have to wrap it up. So I want you to sort of give folks the message why they need to be, if they're in those particular industries you mentioned before, why do they need to bring their business to South Dakota?
Sure. Couple of things. One, we're a very low-tax state, which means we want the business owner to keep their money.
Okay.
That's nice.
Yeah. Second thing is Forbes rated us number one as the lowest cost of business state in 2015.
That's nice, too.
Right. So it doesn't cost a lot to do business. And then the cultural fit that we talked about, it just works. And we want to grow that business in our state.
How can people get more information about what you do?
Right. They can go to our website. It's sdreadytowork.com.
Okay.
And then for my specific industry, you put a slash and shot.
Joe, thanks so much for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
You bet. Thanks, John.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program in the next 60 minutes, Stephen Kruger of PJ Media. Also, Katie Moyer, political writer, will join us. We've got the hero of the day, sponsored by Adcor Defense, deal of the day, good guy of the day. By the way, we're talking with Seton Motley about Charles Sumner and Preston Brooks because, you know, 1856 politics is, we have our finger on the pulse of America and what America wants to talk about. Just so you know, the specific phrasing, apparently, that set Preston Brooks off, Sumner charged Senator Andrew Butler with taking a mistress who, though ugly to others, is always lovely to him, though polluted in the sight of the world, is chaste in his sight. I mean, he said, the harlot slavery. So rather than challenge Charles Sumner to a duel, which is perhaps how you would have treated a gentleman back in those days, he instead approached him with a cane there while he was sitting at his seat in the Senate and proceeded to beat him senseless. All right, now, there you go. A little extra history lesson for you. Our deal of the day, hero of the day, good guy of the day, we'll start with our hero of the day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. Unfortunately, a story could have had a happier ending. It certainly could have had a much worse ending, but a 61-year-old woman there in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, at home in Terrell, Texas, woke up middle of the night, two intruders in her home. CBS Dallas says that she reached for her gun and shot one of the burglars. But when the woman's gun ran out of bullets, she said the uninjured home invader attacked her. She said she didn't want to be named, by the way. She's still concerned for her safety. But she said, he must have heard me clicking it because that's when he came back and he beat me up really bad. You know, every now and then you hear people wonder, oh, why do you need a magazine over 10 rounds? Why do you need over X rounds? Because you don't know how many people are going to be breaking into your home in the middle of the night. For one. The 61-year-old woman said she suffered a concussion, her face covered with cuts and bruises. Now, investigators knew that one of the suspects was shot and was likely going to need medical attention, so they quickly tracked the two suspects down at the Texas Regional Medical Center at Sunnyvale. 21-year-old Saul Guzman found inside the hospital being treated for a non-life-threatening gunshot wound to the stomach. Investigators found the second suspect, 21-year-old Pedro Guzman, sitting in his car across the street from the hospital at a gas station. Terrell Police Captain A.D. Sampson says that investigators also found a stolen purse connected to a different burglary inside a trash can at the gas station. Sansom says, we do believe they may be responsible for other offenses in our city. They have both been charged with burglary of habitation, intent other than felony theft of or assault, theft of firearm, burglary of vehicle. The victim says that she is installing a security system at her home and will be buying another gun. She told CBS 11, quote, I hope other women will take note. I'm glad I was able to defend myself. Now, again, I don't expect Cosmo to cover this story either. 61-year-old women kind of outside of their target demographic, so probably unimportant to their quest to talk about women in firearms ownership. But I think it's interesting. I mean, here you have a woman who was able to defend herself, ultimately not entirely, again, was beaten by one of these suspects.
And she says, you know what? I'm glad that I was able to defend myself. And it didn't work out perfectly for her, but she is still glad that she had that ability to protect herself. And she still chooses to protect herself. Now, again, this woman remains nameless. We can't seek her out for an interview, find out if she plans on changing anything about the type of firearm that she's going to use for self-defense there in her home. But I imagine she's going to be thinking about it. And we are glad that she is alive today. We are glad that the suspects are in custody. And this woman there in Terrell, Texas, today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day from Alabama, Huntsville, Alabama. AL.com says a Guntersville man with a history of shooting into occupied vehicles has been arrested after exchanging gunfire with another man earlier this month, all while a young child sat in a car seat in his vehicle. 29-year-old Brent LaShawn Avery, charged with shooting into an occupied vehicle as well as a probation violation. The incident happened March 13th, there in Guntersville, near the corner of Carlisle Avenue and Hyatt Street. Warrants have been issued for the other shooter, although police haven't released his name. Nobody was injured, but the gunfire nearly struck the child, whose relationship to Brent LaShawn Avery not immediately clear. Now, AL.com says Avery's probation violation involves his previous conviction on a remarkably similar crime. He was charged back in 2010, 6 years ago. Brent LaShawn Avery charged with two counts of attempted murder and shooting into an occupied vehicle for firing into a 1997 Buick LeSabre in which two men were sitting. In June of 2011, so less than 5 years ago, Brent LaShawn Avery pleaded guilty to the reduced charge of shooting into an occupied vehicle. The attempted murder charges get thrown out, but it's totally okay because Brent LaShawn Avery got sentenced to 20 years in prison less than 5 years ago. His sentence, AL.com says, was split, with him ordered to serve 5 years and then remain on probation for another 5 years. Oh, she was only supposed to do 5 years. But wait, it's been less than 5 years. Yeah, June of 2011, and his probation began in March of 2015. So, two counts of attempted murder and shooting into an occupied vehicle get plea bargained down to shooting into an occupied vehicle. But it's okay because he gets a 20-year sentence. But the 20-year sentence translates to 3.5 years behind bars. And again, this is not unusual. This happens so often that stories like this rarely get reported. Rarely do you get this much detail. Avery, by the way, allegedly violated that probation. He went on probation in March of last year. One would think, having served 3.5 years of what's supposed to be a 20-year prison sentence for charges that originally included attempted murder, one would think you'd be on your best behavior when you actually got out of prison. And he's released in March, and in August, he's accused of violating that probation by failing to pay court-ordered fees, and being arrested in July for possession of marijuana. His probation was not revoked, but he was ordered to serve 30 days in the Marshall County Jail as a sanction for the violation. He was given credit for 26 days already served since his arrest, so he was released after just 4 days. And he remained on probation at the time of his arrest on Monday of this week. AL.com says that Brent LaShawn Avery is now being held without bond. He is today's deal of the day. Our good guy today from WVAH TV in Charleston, Huntington, West Virginia. Story out of Barbersville, West Virginia. Officer Stephen Wilson getting a lot of praise after a couple of pictures of the officer found their way onto Facebook. Officer Stephen Wilson was at the Huntington Mall on Monday. A woman being questioned by police, and Officer Stephen Wilson, the woman had her three-year-old child with her. And so Officer Wilson took that three-year-old to get a cold drink, took him into the arcade at the mall while his mom was being questioned. Someone took a picture. He said, I just don't like to see people in need. I just wasn't raised that way. Now, he got a little bit of attention for helping that young child out, but he also got attention for helping out a homeless individual. Another individual on Facebook saw Officer Wilson engaged in another act of kindness, feeding a homeless man. WVAH says a homeless man so thin that Officer Wilson thought he was wearing a back brace. Stephen Wilson said, I said, what are you wearing a back brace for? He goes, back brace? Those are my hip bones. I said, you serious? He goes, yeah. He pulls his shirt up, and sure enough, his waist was about that big around, and it was his hip bones. I said, let's go straight across the street to Wendy's. Sergeant Officer Wilson says that these acts of kindness are not unusual. He says it's not an odd thing. It's odd when you get caught doing it. Because he's not doing this in the hopes that somebody will take a picture and post it to Facebook. He's doing it because he's looking into the eyes of a man who hasn't eaten. He's doing it because he's looking into the eyes of a small child who is freaked out and doesn't understand what's going on. He's not thinking about who might be there with his smartphone. Sergeant Anthony Javidan says that he hopes that this helps change the way that many people perceive police. He said, police in general often get painted with the same brush and villainized in the news. And Javidan said, while Officer Wilson's actions are fantastic, he says they're also not rare in police circles. He said, when the public does capture the good and puts it out there, we really do enjoy it. It helps us out. It makes our jobs easier. People see us as humans. Officer Stephen Wilson says that he does hope that people will acknowledge and maybe take away a little different impression of police officers. He says, you know, people think we love to shoot first and ask questions later, beat people up for no reason. He said, really, it's a complete 180 from that. And I think that Officer Stephen Wilson is right about that. You know, if you are interested in a career in law enforcement so you get to beat the snot out of a lot of innocent people, I got to tell you, you're probably not going to last very long. If, on the other hand, you want to be a member of law enforcement because you want to protect and serve a community, you're going to find opportunities to do so in ways big and small every day. And we thank Officer Stephen Wilson again for being one of the many, many good guys out there. This time, found a good guy in Barbersville, West Virginia. All right, as I mentioned, Katie Moyer is going to join us on the program in just a little bit. Talking about that new video from Cosmo, teaming up, I think, once again with Every Town for Gun Safety. They had their March edition of Cosmopolitan Magazine, a special section on why women really shouldn't date gun owners and certainly shouldn't be a gun owner themselves. Now they're following up here. Watch four women tell their boyfriends how they really feel about their firearms. Not one of them happy with the fact that their boyfriend owns a firearm. At one point, you know, again, and here's some of the arguments that we're getting. And it's interesting because, you know, when the campus carry debate, one of the arguments is, well, college campuses are just they're awash with alcohol. Students are always drunk. There's no way that this can be safe because we're going to have drunken concealed carry holders running around. Even though, again, the truth is that concealed carry holders have to be 21 years of age. They can legally drink. They can legally carry, but they can't legally drink and carry. And that hasn't been an issue in the state of Texas, nor has it been an issue in any of the other states where concealed carry is recognized, or open carry, or permitless carry. Here in the state of Virginia, we had the same argument a few years ago when our concealed carry law changed to allow the lawful carrying of firearms in establishments in which alcohol are sold, or alcohol is sold. And we were told, oh, you do that, man, you're going to have all these drunken gun owners. They're just, oh, it's going to be awful. It's going to be the wild, wild west. And no, it wasn't. There were no issues with drunken concealed carry holders in the Olive Garden or anywhere else. Restaurant robberies actually declined in the first year that the law was in effect. I'm not saying it was because the law went into effect, but there was not an increase in crime. There was a reduction in crime. But one of the arguments in this Cosmo video was, well, look, the guy says, I keep my a gun locked up. And the girlfriend said, so you don't know how to work a lock when you're drunk? And the guy's response, if that's what you're really concerned about, that your boyfriend has issues when he drinks, that's the problem. Your boyfriend has issues when he drinks. Because what happens to his car keys when he drinks, for instance? I mean, if you're concerned about that, right, well, can you still operate a lock? Do you take his keys away on a regular basis? Did that appear in the video? I don't think so. And I don't really know. Again, I don't know anything about these people. I don't know how much of a concern this is for the girlfriend. But it seems like, again, if that's going to be the issue, that's going to be the issue. My boyfriend has a drinking problem. I can't trust my boyfriend when he starts to consume alcohol. Not, I'm dating a gun owner. But we'll talk about this with Katie Moyer after a quick timeout. Stick around. We've got much more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bethany Mullen with NRA Community Outreach about the NRA Refuse to Be a Victim program. Tell us, Bethany, what's the program all about?
Well, Refuse to Be a Victim is a crime prevention and a personal safety program. It was created in 1993 by the women of the NRA. It was created specifically for people who didn't feel comfortable carrying firearms, but they still wanted to take a proactive role in their safety. It was women only from 93 to 97, but now it's open up to everybody since people realize that regardless of whether or not you do carry a firearm, there are situations that you want to be aware of so you can stay safe in your everyday life.
So this is a very successful program for NRA. Why was it important that NRA offer a program like this?
Just for people that, like I said, didn't feel comfortable carrying a firearm but still wanted to create a safety plan for themselves. It's really comprehensive. It goes over a whole bunch of different things. It's a four-hour seminar format. It goes over personal safety, travel security, home security, cybersecurity, a whole bunch more. Everyone that attends a seminar does get a comprehensive safety handbook with a lot of stuff that can't even be covered in the 4 hours. And it's just a lot of good tips that you can integrate into your everyday life to avoid becoming a victim of crime.
That's awesome. And the program, Bethany, has continued to grow and evolve now. Way you mentioned cyber, there's so much security, not only around you physically, but online and everything else you got to be aware of as well.
Yeah.
So who's a typical person who takes this program? You said it's not just women, men and women.
Correct. We really have a wide audience. We're working with a lot of police departments because it is just such a great community outreach. So they offer it to their community. A lot of people go to senior centers and talk to people that live in the senior centers. We're also working with a lot of schools and colleges because that's such a vulnerable age. You know, a lot of 18-year-olds leaving home for the first time. And college campuses, you know, obviously seem very safe, but behind the scenes there's a lot that goes on, and so we want to make people aware of how to stay safe.
How do you get more information about NRA Refuse to Be a Victim?
Well, you can go online to refuse.nra.org or email us at refuse@nrahq.org.
You know the threat is real. You sit in meetings with advisors and operatives who tell you there could be Islamic sleeper cells in every major American community. You know the southern border is a welcome mat for terrorists to enter our towns and neighborhoods at will. You know about their plots to kill us in our shopping malls, our sports stadiums, and our office buildings. You won your office by talking like a champion of freedom. Now it's time to act like one. Pass a national right to carry law that guarantees my constitutional right to defend myself, my family, and my fellow Americans anywhere inside our borders. And make sure the enemies of freedom know the power of freedom. No law-abiding American should be forced to face evil with empty hands. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago. You know it as one of the most dangerous cities in America. I know it as something less than America, a place where the law doesn't matter. It's illegal for criminal gang members, drug dealers, and felons to even touch a gun. Chicago's politicians could clean the streets tomorrow just by enforcing that federal law. But they would rather attack the gun rights of good people than crack down on the violent criminals who terrorize them. So law-abiding Southsiders put their kids to bed to the sound of gunfire, with no hope but to pray it doesn't come closer. Chicago's injustice is America's problem. Either we fight this cancer of corruption or we pray it doesn't come closer. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media coming up on the program in just a little bit. Right now, I want to welcome to the show Katie Moyer once again with us on the program. How are you doing, Katie?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on again.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good talking with you. And, you know, it's interesting. Obviously, I am not the target demographic for Cosmopolitan magazine. In many ways. And I recognize that. I'm okay with that. But Cosmo is out there. They started with this March edition. They teamed up with Every Town for Gun Safety. I think we might have even talked about this a little bit in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, when we had you on the show. Now they've got this new video out. Watch four women tell their boyfriends how they really feel about their guns. We shared this a little bit yesterday. And, Katie, I'm sure you've had a chance to see this. So you know that... none of the women are happy with the fact that their boyfriends are gun owners.
No, I'm surprised that the video didn't end with anybody breaking up. Because a couple of those girls were a little bit potty about the issue. It was that was quite interesting and one-sided way to present the issue.
there was that moment where one of the women said, you know, listen, I'm not interested in having a gun in the home if we have a kid, right?
Uh-huh.
And the boyfriend said, well, what about when he gets older? And there was no. There was some definite tension there.
Definitely.
But what I'm curious about is the fact that that was the only position represented. I mean, where was the... Because, I know that these women are out there. I think I'm talking to one right now. Where was the woman who didn't have a problem with her boyfriend owning a firearm?
I think there were a bunch of issues with that video. The one thing that I found really surprising was the girl who rolled her eyes when the guy referred to the Second Amendment and it being part of the Constitution. The females they had in that video, really, they're a great representation of, I think, females from the left. There was no other representation there. Just the idea that you know, that the Constitution isn't really as important, even though you know, the Second Amendment's written into our Constitution. And some of the comments that they made were, it was hard for me to watch through the whole thing because it was really frustrating to see people be so uneducated about an issue that clearly their partner is passionate about.
Well, yeah, and this, you know, so I think right from the get-go, as you say, there were,
I don't want to be accused of being a gunsplainer because Cosmo's already called me that, but I almost wanted to sit down and say, hey, you know, you guys aren't really handling this very well. But I think that that was part of Cosmo's intent, right?
They didn't, I think so, too.
I don't think they wanted to show a conversation. I think they wanted to show a confrontation.
Well, one of the interesting things that I noticed was that one of the males in the video was law enforcement. You saw that he had his weapon on his side, and he also had his badge there. And that was the guy that they asked about. The one girl said, oh, well, you know, I'm scared that, you know, a kid would get their hands on the gun and then they'd accidentally shoot them. And they cut to the guy who just literally said, it won't happen. But I felt like the editing was really craftily done because he's a law enforcement officer. I feel like there had to have been more to that conversation than him just dismissing it, saying, oh, well, it won't happen. It was some crafty editing by Cosmopolitan, definitely.
So how effective was it, do you think, Katie, as a piece of anti-gun propaganda?
I think that was really good for them. I think that it was great propaganda for them in the way that the way that it was presented. The females were super dominant in the video, and the males didn't have any good responses. Some of the things that they talked about are obviously legitimate concerns, but there are also answers to those questions that those guys either didn't say or it wasn't in the final cut of the video. Just things like, you know, if you have your gun locked up, you know, just there were a bunch of answers that they could have just talked about how being a responsible gun owner is what you have to be. If you own a gun, you have to be responsible. And there are different safety things that they could have talked about, but they really glossed over all of it. And it made the women look like they were very passionately concerned about their boyfriends who are doing this awful thing called owning a gun. So very interesting.
It is really interesting. And I'm, you know, I'm not exactly happy that you said you thought this was effective, but could get your honest opinion here. You know, part of the thing, part of what I guess bothers me is that this is obviously very one-sided. So The day, I think it was the same day that this Cosmo video was released, we also saw news out of Indianapolis, Indiana, of a young mom at home with her infant child. Guy breaks into her house. He's got zip ties. He's got a walkie-talkie. And mom is able to defend herself and her child. And police, again, made the discovery that he had these items on him, which perhaps indicates that he had an accomplice somewhere and who knows what was being planned. But doesn't look like he was just there to steal the TV, you know?
Absolutely.
And Cosmo will never report on that story. They will never let their audience
really
know about
that. Out. That's such an important thing. A lot of people own their guns for protection. And I really wish that one of the boyfriends in that video would have said, you know, well, how do you feel about me having a gun if somebody breaks into our apartment when it's just, you know, you and I there? Or if it's just you there, you know, what are you going to do if somebody breaks in and you can't defend yourself? The whole element of defense was left out of that conversation, which is what the left likes to do when it comes to guns, which is why I feel like it was it was successful, unfortunately, on their part that, you know, it works to their audience. That's going to work. It plays so well to young females. I loved that the one guy said, you know, I wish that you would have been exposed to guns earlier. You know, you wouldn't be scared because that's how I am. I used to be afraid of guns until I was exposed to them because I just didn't know anything except for guns from TV shows and stuff like that. And so I thought that was at least a good point, but I doubt that the people who are reading Cosmopolitan are going to pull out that gem.
It'd be interesting. I'm sure that Cosmo would never print those letters to the editor, but I'd be curious to know if they actually did get any feedback because, look, maybe it's just the job that I do, but I know a lot of women who are in that sort of target audience for Cosmopolitan who are absolutely gun owners, and they are very proud of that fact. They're very vocal about that fact. And again, they're not going to be represented. You know, we were just talking a couple weeks ago, Jenny Thrasher, NCAA rifle champion, a college freshman there at West Virginia University. Now, I don't think that Jenny is carrying a firearm for self-defense, but here is a gun owner. Here is somebody who is putting herself through college on an athletic scholarship because of her shooting ability. There's another story that I think Cosmo will ignore. Marie Claire, not interested. They, you know, they don't want to have an honest and open discussion. They want to preach their point of view.
And I can only imagine the outrage if it were like a pro-gun type of thing. I couldn't imagine Cosmopolitan ever putting anything out like that. That's really missing a large group of females, because we are gun owners and we protect ourselves and we hunt and we shoot. And I think that they're missing out. But I can only imagine the outrage if somebody would have said something positive about guns in that video.
Well, you know, there would have been quiet consternation, I think, on the set, and there would have been a knowing look between the producer and the director of, okay, that's getting cut, right? I don't think that there, it just would have been quietly excised from the record, because that's not what they were looking for.
That's sad, because it perpetuates the myth that guns need to be scary, especially for females. When I put my hands on a gun for the first time, it was the most empowering thing I've ever done. And I think if more females in particular are exposed to guns, that they wouldn't be afraid. It's definitely just a myth surrounding all of this. And those kind of videos put out by Cosmo definitely don't help.
You know, you talk about the feeling that you had of empowerment the first time that that you held a firearm. Were you, Katie, were you goaded into gun ownership? Did you have a bunch of guys telling you, listen, little lady, you need to start packing heat? Is that how you became a gun owner? You just finally decided, forget it, I'm just going to file, go to the range? Or did it happen differently?
Well, it was two things that really got me into it. One was with my college Republican chapter. We went to the gun range for fun, and we did a safety course, and then we shot off a bunch of guns, which was really, really exciting. So once I finally got my hand on a gun, I wasn't afraid, and I was very empowered, but I wasn't quite convinced that I needed to buy one. I was just okay with it at that point. And then I had an experience where I was followed downtown in a city when I was going to work, and it really frightened me, and it was my breaking point where I was I need to be able to defend myself if I'm in any situation like this. So that's when I decided I wanted to buy myself a gun for self-defense.
That is, I love hearing these stories of how people came to this decision, because, you know, again, this is something that anti-gun activists, rarely, if ever, do they give gun owners credit for reaching that decision on their own, right?
Mm-hmm.
Usually, it's you got some phone call from somebody who said, hey, this is the gun lobby. have you thought about owning a gun, because you really should own a gun? There's somebody outside your house right now, and we're trying to scare you into owning a gun. It's always, right, it's never that you actually made that rational, you thought this through. This wasn't the other thing is some spur of the moment decision. You're just driving by a gun store, and all of a sudden you just do a UE and you pull in. I've got to have one right now. And that
right.
just doesn't. That's not. I've never met a gun owner that's been their experience. But again, I think it's another really easy way for anti-gun activists to try to otherize gun owners, to make them seem different, right? They're not
right.
free thinkers. They're not really thinking this through. They're just tools and pawns of the gun lobby.
And I think that's so ironic, because I think most gun owners really think these things through and are extra responsible, because you have to be responsible if you own a firearm. And I think that's just the irony of it. So, gun owners, you need to be responsible. You need to train. You need to know what you're doing. You can't just leave your firearm out. The things that the people in the video were bringing up, they're legitimate points for people who don't really know a lot about guns. But if you're owning a gun, you have to be responsible with it. And I think gun owners know that.
I think you're absolutely right. I think gun owners do know that. Clearly, not everybody in that video knew that. I mean, one of the things that we talked about in the last segment that just kind of threw me was one of the boyfriends said, but look, I keep my guns locked up. And his girlfriend said almost immediately, well, do you know how to operate a lock when you're drunk? Right. It doesn't matter if you keep them locked up, because you can still get them when you're drunk and stupid. And my first reaction to that was, well, where are his car keys? It sounds to me like maybe your concern shouldn't be my boyfriend owns a gun. It sounds to me like maybe you're thinking your concern is my boyfriend drinks too much.
Right.
Which is I got to tell you, that's a completely different problem there.
Or he's just irrational. There are other problems than just what's
she was citing there. So
yeah, it like I said, there were had a lot of issues with that video, but I appreciate you coming on the program talking about some of your issues with the video. How's everything up there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania?
Things are pretty great out here. We finally got a budget passed in Pennsylvania, so I'm happy about that. And we're working on some medical marijuana here in this state, too, which is great for our state. So pretty excited. Things are happening.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, Katie, and look forward to talking to you again very soon.
You as well.
Katie Moyer joins us, political writer up there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, talking about her first piece, actually. What inspired her to start writing was the issue of a campus carry and why people should not be afraid of a campus carry. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media is going to join us on the program. I know we already did our deal of the day today, but there is another story out there that is at least worth acknowledging. Barack Obama commuting the prison sentences of 61 individuals today, most of them drug offenders, all of them drug offenders, most of them nonviolent drug offenders. Some of them, on the other hand, did have some firearm-related offenses to their name. Emily Zanotti on Twitter wondered if President Obama was aware of this. Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the president was aware of all of the charges that these individuals had been facing and all of the crimes that they had been sentenced for. But again, keep in mind, this is the president who has overseen a drop in federal weapons cases overall, right? So it's not necessarily about enforcing the laws on the books as much as it is about putting more laws there on the books. So don't be surprised by this news. Again, this is the same administration who that again agreed to a 1-year probation for that individual there in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who was illegally buying and selling firearms. Eligible for many, many more years behind bars. Eligible for years behind bars. Didn't get a day. Got a year's probation. All while the president stumping about the need for more gun laws to affect you and me and other lawful gun owners out there. All right, when we come back here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Mr. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media joins us. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this. Sitting down with us as well, NRA Iowa Executive Director Chris Cox. Chris, how are you, sir?
Cam, I'm doing well. It's great to be with you today.
Well, it's great to have you here. We were just listening to Wayne LaPierre get the crowd on their feet talking about the importance of this year's election and making sure that a Clinton does not return to the White House to go after our rights once again. We were just talking with David again about how it was back in the 1990s. Here you have Hillary Clinton.
He's younger.
On the campaign stump right now, saying that she's going to go after the NRA. She wants to make sure that the NRA doesn't exist anymore, right? She wants to end the NRA. What's your response to Hillary Clinton? What's your message to gun owners and NRA members?
Well, I had a couple takeaway from Wayne's speech today. And one was that no matter what they say and no matter how long they say it, their dishonesty proves over and over again that we're right. You saw the young Wayne talking about a lack of prosecutions, a young Wayne speaking what all people all across the country already know, and it's that we need to focus on people who are causing problems and leave those of us alone who aren't. So just the basic fundamental premise of gun control being a failure was reinforced and has been reinforced not only throughout the last 20, 25 years, but throughout the history of the world, that it's a failed policy, it's a failed idea. And the other thing is that just like the past history of this country, we have an opportunity to do something about it, that it's not too late. That as Americans, we have the ability to participate, but we have to participate. This is an election where no one gets to sit on the sidelines. This is not an election where we can sit around afterwards and complain about the results, because the results are going to be so damaging to this country and so damaging to the core principles that make this country great, that what we do between now and Election Day really will mean the difference of what this country is going to look like for the next 40 or 50 years. This is an election with long-term consequences based on, Wayne talked about it, with regards to the Supreme Court. this balance of the basic right to own a firearm, we won that court case 5-4. One vote, we no longer have 5-4 based on the tragic loss of Justice Scalia. So literally the stakes of this election just got higher.
And Mrs. Clinton's comment and her reaction to the Heller decision, which is the decision that Chris is talking about, is that she wants a Supreme Court that will reverse it. And yet she says she believes really down deep in firearms ownership as long as it's got common sense restrictions. That decision had one simple question that it answered. Those who favored the decision that came out, the five justices, said, yes, the Constitution means that individual, private American citizens have a right to keep and bear arms, to own firearms. The other side, the four votes, said, no, it doesn't. And what Mrs. Clinton is saying is that she does not believe that anybody in your audience has a right to own or to use a firearm for any legitimate purpose.
And that's probably the most honest thing she said in years.
That's exactly
because
right.
Because it was a moment of honesty.
And as a result, what's happened in the importance of this election, to use a poker analogy, is everybody is all in. Yeah. The chips are all on the table.
Yeah.
If Mrs. Clinton wins, you can bet that there will be an assault like we've never seen before on the Second Amendment, and with the death of Justice Scalia, a real tragedy, not just for Second Amendment believers, but for believers in freedom and the Constitution, with the death of Justice Scalia, she would have the power on day one to appoint somebody to the Supreme Court who would, in fact, effectuate the reversal of Heller and declare the Second Amendment basically void. That's how important this election is.
This is not NRA making this up. These are the words of Justice Ginsburg, who spoke not long after the Heller decision came down to a group at the National Press Club. I mean, this is not a private event where she said she looked forward to the day that a future wiser court came back and overturned these controversial 5-4 decisions like Heller. She said that this basic right to own a firearm was controversial and needed to be overturned, and if Hillary Clinton wins, she's going to get her wish. And what that does is it's much bigger than teaching our kids that there's no individual right to own a firearm in textbooks. This will set this freedom in this country back 50 years, if not forever. So we have not only an opportunity in this election, we have a responsibility. Whether you own guns or not, if you care about the basic right to choose for yourself, whether or not you want to engage in the shooting sports, choose for yourself whether or not you want to keep a firearm to defend yourself, or you just think that women in this country ought to be able to make that decision themselves, this is an election you have to participate in.
Welcome back to NRA News, Gamma Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. Mr. Steven Cruiser of PJ Media is with us on the program right now. How you doing, Steven?
Fine, thank you. I would just like to point out ahead of time here that the reason you didn't have anything to pick through from my writings in the last week is because PJ Media was under a DDoS attack for like a week long.
Seriously? I knew that you guys had gone through an attack, but I didn't realize that it had lasted that long.
Yeah, it went on forever. And who knows? North Koreans. They're all coming from overseas.
Well,
that was interesting.
You have no shortage of enemies there at PJ Media.
Yeah, it's probably just me, but
it's some random guy. Just, you know, I hate Steven Cruiser. I will make sure that he can't write a thing. Well, you know, I mean, you talk about North Korea. I just saw the news that North Korea is telling the people there, get ready to eat roots again. I mean, they're actually telling people there's a famine coming. Start eating roots. The last time there was a huge famine, I think it was, 1994 through 1998, right after the fall of the Soviet Union, China was dealing with its own economic issues. Nobody was really there to bail out North Korea. They ended up exporting a lot of their food to prop up the regime, and you had millions of people who starved to death. I read a story from a North Korean defector, read her biography recently, and she was talking about how people were eating leaves because of the famine. I mean, you know, you're literally putting anything in your body that provides an ounce of energy. And now you've got the state of North Korea saying, hey, it's coming again. So maybe they're spending all of that food money on denial of service attacks against PJ Media.
It's cyber warfare and their nukes that they're not building, air quotes. Let's not gloss over the fact either that that political system that creates that kind of dark, awful society that starves its own people is currently being romanticized by tens and hundreds of thousands and millions of young Bernie Sanders supporters in this country.
Well, it's also being, I think it's fair to say it's being minimized by the president of the United States.
Yeah.
You know, in Argentina, when he said, I realize our regular listeners may be ready for me to move on from this. This may be the single most mind-boggling thing that the president has said to me in 7 years, where he said that there really is no difference between capitalism and communism. Just get beyond these labels, go with what works. And, you know, Stephen, what works for who, right? I mean, Kim Jong-un would say that North Korea is working pretty well for him. He's got enough to eat. He's got a whole country that's his playground. So, you know, what works for who, I guess, is the biggest question there.
Yeah, the political elite are never in any of these scenarios. They are basically the same. They're just living off the sweat and the labor of the people whom they purport to represent. But, yeah, what the president said, though, is so typical of modern American liberalism. It's an entire political philosophy built upon false equivalencies. You take away their false equivalencies, they've got nothing. So that's how they can start talking about the labels and the this and that, and it's all one and kumbaya, and John Lennon's dead. Give it up, okay? Stop imagining, because everything isn't the same. And the reason we have labels is because things are different. You know, they try to act like if you label something as other, it's different than you, that it's inherently bad that you did that. And it's not. Not everybody's the same. Not all political systems are the same. Not all countries are the same. Not all leaders are the same. And people need to start acting like adults and admitting that again.
Absolutely. Stephen Kruger joins us on the program. So you just tweeted something about this Cosmo video we were talking about.
Yes.
Watch four women told their boyfriends how they really feel about their guns. How do you really feel about this video, Stephen? Recognizing that you are not exactly the target audience for said video.
My fiance, when she first saw it today, she said, "So is Cosmo saying that only men own guns? Is that what the implication is supposed to be here?" And I said, "Yeah, it would seem like that. You know, because you know, in the pejorative sense, it's supposed to be just like some kind of thing that we need to feel macho. That's what the liberals like
right.
to tell you." And so that fits in with that narrative right there. Now, thankfully, I am engaged to a beautiful woman who's just going, "We need to buy more guns, all the time." So I'm quite the opposite. I'm definitely not the target audience for this. But yeah, the implication is that it's just some stupid macho fantasy, and it's not really a riot anymore, and you don't need it. And wasn't one of the premises on that it's not a guaranteed constitutional right? That it's just something like the men are imagining it almost.
Yeah, that's, you know, as you say, it's this false version of reality that they're presenting here, where there are no women who own guns because they've already all been convinced by Cosmo not to own a gun, right? They've apparently all melted them down into sculptures or jewelry or something. And so what is left, as you say, is this world where there are only guys who own guns who might pressure women to own guns or who might be kind of shady and they're dating these women. But, you know, what's fascinating about this, when you talk about this, so it wasn't just Cosmo. Marie Claire also had a big piece in their March issue about women and guns. And they actually interviewed, I know of at least two females who own guns who were interviewed by Marie Claire that Marie Claire decided not to to use their answers. Julie Golub, who is the captain of Team Smith & Wesson, and a gun-owning mom. Antonia Okafor with Students for Concealed Carry, both very well-spoken, thoughtful individuals who were not heard from because I don't think it fit the agenda. And, you know, look, I don't know that anybody reads Cosmo for serious news. I don't know that anybody reads Marie Claire for serious news, but they certainly didn't get it. I mean, what they got was, they got propaganda from from the gun control groups.
Well, and Julie's a well-adjusted, happy woman, too, so they wouldn't want to.
So is Antonia. I mean, that's the thing, right?
I don't know. I don't interact with her as much, but Julie's really happy. She's out there. She's a heck of a shot.
Yep.
And, yeah, that wouldn't fit any of it, because you got to be – it's really kind of mind-boggling that women-run organizations are leaning on women to be more defenseless. It's kind of like you try to wrap your head around that, and it just makes no sense whatsoever. Then again, they think that they can legislate away all the bad in the world, too, which is, it's all part of going back to the nasty political philosophy that just doesn't quite work. They really do think that enough laws will eventually just make the bad people go away.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, we saw Hillary Clinton. She was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin yesterday. Milwaukee saw a pretty big increase in their homicides last year. And Hillary Clinton talked about the need for more gun control laws. We're going to put more gun control laws on the books.
Yeah.
She blamed the NRA, blamed law-abiding gun owners. She didn't say a word, Stephen, about the case out of Milwaukee last August, federal prosecutors agreeing to a one-year probation for an individual who used a fake ID to illegally purchase 27 guns, and then he illegally sold those 27 guns. This was prosecuted at the federal level, and the federal judge gave this guy a year's probation after prosecutors agreed. Again, we already have laws on the books. Here's a guy who armed criminals in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at a time in which homicides were rising. He got a slap on the wrist because the judge said he was impressed that he was pursuing a rap career and had gone out to California while he was awaiting trial and had appeared in a movie, apparently. Hillary Clinton isn't going to mention that. She's not going to talk. I mean, she's got to continue these policies, but at the same time, she's not willing to really address why we are seeing violent crime increase in places like Milwaukee or Chicago. She wants to blame it on the people who are not committing these crimes while refusing to acknowledge the human beings who actually are.
You know what I would like to see from anyone coming from the non-Democrat side of the aisle, whether they be Libertarian or Republican or whichever hybrid party sprouts up after this election, is, it's boilerplate stuff for the Democrats. They're always saying more gun control laws, more money for education. Those are the two things they like to, they just immediately respond to any problem out there. And no one ever presses them for specifics, for delineation. Okay, exactly where do you draw the line? Which gun control laws will make you satisfied? And then you'll stop this. At what point will you stop this? And if they start to say, well, when the crime, no. Which laws specifically do you want on the books that aren't on there right now that will make you say we don't need more laws? That's what I would like to see somebody hammer them on like that. And then they've got nothing. They either have to admit that they want to abolish all gun rights, or they'll just flounder and flounder and flounder, which they'll probably do. But nobody ever presses them for specifics. They let them go with the soft narrative stuff like, well, we need more gun control laws, and then nobody ever hits them on it.
You're right. Nobody does. And I think it's because a lot of times those who would be in the position of questioning the politicians agree with the politicians. I think in those rare cases where you have reporters who are, let's say, they don't have an opinion. They honestly just haven't thought about it that much. They also probably don't have the background knowledge to ask those questions because they don't know the issue. And so, you've got two separate issues, I think, going on. But you're right. When was the last time Hillary Clinton or Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer or Barack Obama, Barack Obama went on the CNN town hall style event, right, where he had his questions that CNN had picked out for him. But there was no chance for a follow up. I mean, even there, Stephen, we talked with Kimberly Corbin, who got a chance to ask the president a question. She thought she was actually going to have a dialogue, but once she had asked that question, the microphone goes away. You're told to just kind of stand there, and the president gives you his response, and then they move on. So you're right. I mean, there's another very scripted situation that is designed to not allow for that a line of questioning to develop from somebody who's actually knowledgeable about this issue.
No, because then you would get into specifics. Then you would get into the minutiae of the issue, and then the Democrats don't want that at all. It has to be broad brush stroke. stuff that appeals to emotions that really doesn't. More laws will protect you. More money for education will magically make everybody smarter. More and never, okay, more money for education, what are we going to spend it on? More gun laws, which gun laws? You know, you could, most Democrats don't even know which gun laws are on the books already. I mean, you hear them all the time talking about, well, there are no background checks here in a place that's got background checks.
Mm-hmm.
And they're never even aware of that because they're so allowed to just maintain this nonsensical narrative of theirs that they've never been challenged by other politicians. Either. That's what I want to see some Republican politicians get out there and start pressing them for details.
Absolutely. Stephen, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. We're unfortunately almost out of time. Now that the denial of service attack is over, you don't have an excuse not to write anything for PJ Media.
No, I'm going to start blogging right now, but I'm fairly certain somebody in North Korea is looking through the camera on my monitor now.
Well, listen, we wish you the very best of luck. If it helps, just start singing songs from Team America World Police and see if that. I don't think they're allowed to listen, so
no.
You might be safe. All right. Thanks, Stephen. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Stephen Kruser joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. We do only have about 60 seconds left here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. But the good news is it's only Wednesday, so coming up on tomorrow's show, we will have more of the day's top stories for you. Again, legislative sessions underway all around the country. A couple of them have already wrapped up, but we still have a lot of live bills out there, including some bills in Arizona to talk about. We've got a right to carry bill in New Hampshire that we'll be discussing as well. News out of Mississippi and more. All coming up right here on the very next edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Thanks so much for joining us today. Be safe, have fun until we talk again. And we'll see you here soon on another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company.